Good evening, everybody. I'm Justin Goffin here on The Download with you till 11 o'clock tonight on 720 WGN. How's everybody doing out there in Chicagoland, the greater Midwest region? It's always hard to say just Chicago when it's WGN because it is AM radio and it's nighttime. And someone's probably listening this in Oklahoma right now. And if that is the case, good day to you. Got a great show lined up tonight. I'm very excited to be on this. I mean, it's getting to that time of year. It's beautiful here on Michigan Avenue in downtown Chicago. I mean, they have all the Christmas and holiday decorations are up. The studio is decorated here in the Allstate Showcase Studio. Too many S's. And I'm excited to be here. I mean, it's at night. It's sort of like that brisk, cold night in Chicago where at 2:45 it starts to get dark. You know, that's the vibe today. I'm getting off the bus going, something's amiss. This is going to be one of your longer days in the calendar year here in Chicago. All right, we got a great show tonight. As I said to Ro, it's a very eclectic show coming up. First, we'll talk with Mike Fouché, as we do every Wednesday night here. We'll talk about honorary street signs and whether there was a move today to get rid of them entirely. If you're not familiar, Chicago, pretty much every street has an honorary street sign to honor someone who was associated with the city of Chicago or the area in which that street is located. It's kind of gotten to the point where everybody who's anybody is getting a street sign, and we see with the kerfuffle over Donald Trump's honorary street sign in front of the Trump Tower that they just want to do away with the practice. We'll talk about whether or not that went anywhere in city council today. Also, it is the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor. We'll talk with photographer and noted author and historian Richard Cahan. He's got a new book about, you know, I kind of said in the promo today, it's very interesting because we talk about the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor, and you'll say this is the date that as President Roosevelt said, the date that will live in infamy. Well, one, you know, as infamous and if not, you know, at the same level of war and dark periods of our country is internment camps. And after that attack on Pearl Harbor, the United States took Japanese Americans from California and shipped them to internment camps to live out the World War, essentially 3 years' time plus. And we'll talk with Rich Cahan, who found a bunch in the National Archive and the Department of War documented the move. So they hired some really fantastic and noted photographers of the time to take pictures of people when they were leaving their homes, their businesses, whether it be in San Francisco or other Central California, and documented that transition to the camps in Wyoming and other places. And in it, he went through and he found some of the younger people that were showcased or that were featured in his photography. And he tracked them down and interviewed them about the experience. The book is called Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II. So we'll talk with Rich Cahan coming up at the big table at 8 o'clock. Malcolm London joins us tonight, noted poet, activist, and now hip-hop musician. He's got a new record, Opia, which is out. We'll talk with Malcolm London a little bit later in the show. Also, I'm really excited about this. Kelly Kitley will be here. She's a therapist here in Chicago, and she has written an autobiography called Myself. Essentially, the concept of when you're going through something and you're talking to your therapist and you're like, I wonder if this therapist can understand. Kelly, she understands. She talks about her life and dealing with a lot of emotional issues, including sexual assault, eating disorders, addiction, divorce, you know, as a child and a child of divorce. We'll talk with Kelly about those experiences and what that means for her being a therapist here in town. And we'll also talk with Sam Panionovich about the White Sox. I'm very excited about this, Pete. I really like what they're doing. Adam Eaton for Lucas Giolito. I'll take that. I was like, Adam Eaton's still on this team? Sounds good to me. So a lot to do tonight, so we'll get to it. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. Like I said, we got a huge show tonight, so let's get to it. Start with the carryout. This, of course, our nightly segment where I read the news, so you at home, you don't have to. today's top stories. Mayor Rahm Emanuel traveled to New York for official business and to meet with the president-elect Donald Trump. It was a cordial meeting, and Emanuel said he spoke about being a sanctuary city for immigrants. At the same time, Chicago was finally taking down the honorary Trump street sign next to the Trump Tower. So was this just a weird diversion, like a slapstick comedy? You know what? I'll meet with him. I'll distract him from reading Breitbart, and you guys take down the sign. Well, hopefully the mayor made a good impression for all of the city, but something tells me this was less about Chicago and more about him. I've been a mayor. I've worked in Congress. I play bass on the side. I can do whatever you like, sir. President-elect Donald Trump chose Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt as his nominee for the head of the Environmental Protection Agency. The only problem is that Pruitt is suing the current Environmental Protection Agency for the Clean Power Plan, and he is an unabashed climate change denier. Not exactly who you'd want running our environmental policy, but then again, that's what Trump promised, right? I think that was the slogan. Trump, not exactly who you want running things. What does it mean? Well, it means a huge win for coal and oil, two industries that Pruitt aligns himself with. This, of course, all happened after Al Gore met with Trump at the White House yesterday. So something tells me that Gore pulled out the old PowerPoint and Trump nodded off, much like the country did when Gore ran for president. Also, John Kelly nominated to run Homeland Security. He pledged to keep Guantanamo Bay open, and he's pushed back against women in combat. Oh, that's okay. And rounding out today's dream team, Trump appoints Linda McMahon to head the Small Business Administration. McMahon runs the WWE with husband Vince McMahon, and she gave millions to Trump during his campaign. I mean, small business development's always been known as the suplex of economics, so no, it hasn't. This is just pay to play. Okay, got it. Making sure. But Wall Street doesn't seem to mind. The Dow closed today at the highest point since the election, actually the 12th record day since early November. So, you know what? Who cares about the planet? Who cares about torture? Who cares about small business cage matches? We've got stocks, and that's the one thing you can take with you. Oh, you can't? Really? It's all fake? It's not real? Oh, great. Scientists are working on a robot primate that can jump higher than any other living species. Yep, more than a monkey, more than a frog, more than a kangaroo. And sometimes I feel like I'm the only one who has ever watched sci-fi. Why in God's name would you invent that? Right? I mean, has anybody seen Starship Troopers? This is going to end bad. It's going to end with these jumping things coming down and drilling holes in our head. No? Seriously, Sci-Fi Channel, watch. Some scientist is on the hook for this. In weather, it's cold. Yesterday, I tried to walk about 8 blocks without a coat. That experience is going to haunt my dreams forever. In sports, a day after the Chris Sale trade and the White Sox are not done, they continue to overhaul the team by sending outfielder Adam Eaton to the Nationals for highly touted prospect Lucas Giolito. And change. There's change, too. Huge. They have moved Chris Sale and Adam Eaton for two of the best prospects in baseball. I love it. Don't stop, Rick. Keep it going, Kenny. I'm excited about these moves. Yes, Chris Sale, great pitcher, one of the best in baseball. But at the same time, he kind of made it pretty clear he didn't want to play for the White Sox. Yoel Moncada, the big prospect from Boston, talked to the media today, saying he's hoping to be with the White Sox for a long time, and he'll play anywhere, and he hates kids in the locker room, and he doesn't own scissors. So, already an upgrade. Come on, now you got to trade Todd Frazier for Yasiel Puig. Yes, to the Dodgers. Imagine Puig on the South Side, hitting late inning bombs and making huge errors, all the while sporting a cool millennial haircut. We got to have him. He does customized shoes. So cool. Doesn't mind getting fined. On the North Side, the dismantling has begun. I kid. Jorge Soler was traded straight up for the Royals closer Wade Davis. Davis has been a great relief pitcher for Kansas City, and he gives the Cubs some much-needed bullpen depth. This also means no more chapstick. Aroldis Chapman will probably sign with the Yankees again, because I guess that's what you do. And Soler makes room for Kyle Schwarber to take over left field. Or is it Zorro, Ben Zobrist? Or Double A, Albert Almora Jr., right? John Jay, I know he's in the mix. Really, they still got some work to do out there. Something tells me there's going to be a lot of early season back injuries. Ah, 15-day DL. Ugh. I call that the Soler. I think there's something wrong with Soler's hammy. No, there's not, coach. It's fine. Hey, you're on the bench. The Blackhawks won without Jonathan Toews and Corey Crawford. They blanked the Yotes last night. God, they're too good this year. They really are. They're back on the ice on Friday. The Bulls lost for the third straight time last night to Detroit. Not good. The Bulls sit at 11-10 on the season. Really? All that fun basketball and we're one game above 500? And to make matters worse, essentially every team in the Central without LeBron James is within one game of each other. So like I said all along, the NBA, it really doesn't start till after Christmas. And in football, the Bears get ready for the NFC North leading Lions in Detroit. Unnamed sources say there's a rift between defensive coordinator Vic Fangio and head coach John Fox, and that Fangio will most likely be gone next year, although everybody, including Fangio, denies it. You know what? Here's the idea of the year. Let's get rid of everybody. Cool? No, I think we should get Ron Rivera. They're terrible in Carolina. Maybe they'll make the mistake to fire Ron Rivera and he can come here and we can get all 85 Bears up in here again. That's the Chicago Bears way, right? When in doubt, go 85 Bears. And finally tonight, a new study says that if you have an optimistic outlook on life, you will live longer. Women who were more positive were less likely to have life-threatening diseases like cancer or stroke. Nah, you know what? I'm just not buying it. Everything in this world is wrong, and I just, life is great. I guess it's true. Whew. Well, that's the carryout for December 7, 2016. Hey, it's your lucky day. For a limited time, we're giving away 2 to 3 wet naps for every order. Hey, life's sloppy. You're welcome. All right, coming up, we'll talk about whether or not the city of Chicago is getting rid of those pesky honorary street signs.
Man.
A lot of real important stuff happening in city council.
Those brown signs.
Mike Fouché is here. He'll break it all down. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
Yasiel Puig. What's wrong with you?
You're not a Puig fan, huh?
No.
I think he brings a much-needed excitement and energy to the South Side of Chicago, and he brings baseball back.
You know, I'd like much-needed wins.
I think he's just misunderstood. I think he's a misunderstood genius.
The language barrier, I see. Yes.
Right now, nobody wants him, so I think they're all in your camp in the idea that nobody wants Yasiel Puig, but I think we should give everything we have to get that guy to Chicago.
And there's a reason why a lot of clubs don't want him.
I think it's a language barrier, and I think that he'll come here, and he'd probably be the best guy ever. We'll have him on the show.
We just got rid of Edward Scissorhands, okay? You want to bring in Puig?
I think more opportunities to say Puig.
Yes.
It would be good.
Puig. Yeah.
Well, I can dream, so.
Puig with another one.
Yeah. Puig. It would be more like, Puig watches Strike 3. Puig doesn't have his shoes on out in right field. What's happening there?
How is he laying off pitches so close?
It was a Puig.
That's right. Right.
It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Mike Fouché is in the building. It's Wednesday.
Hey.
He is the man behind DailyLine.net. You can also check out the podcast.
The Aldercast.
The Aldercast, yeah. Which is getting all hot.
It is hot.
It's a hot podcast.
It's two smart ladies from radio that do a podcast. They're really good.
Where can you find it?
At iTunes, Stitcher, WGN Plus, all that stuff.
There you go. So Aldercast,
check
it out.
Every Friday afternoon.
All right, so let's talk about, we got some stuff to talk about. Why don't we talk mainly, the lead today is Rahm Emanuel goes to New York City to kiss the ring of the president-elect, Donald Trump.
Well, you know,
you gotta.
He is the president-elect.
It used to be, you know, I thought the phone call would be enough, but not so. He goes to New York. What was this meeting about? I mean,
so, you know, there's something really interesting, which is that Rahm Emanuel was senior advisor and chief of staff or deputy chief of staff in two separate administrations.
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of talk about how the Trump guys haven't really been able to find themselves in the dark, you know, with getting together in the White House.
Yeah, the transition's a little
wonky,
right?
Who is somebody who would know about that stuff but, you know, good old Rahm Emanuel. And so, you know, he goes by and is like, well, you know, this is where you find the copy paper and all that stuff. And he tells him how to do that. But at the same time, he also says that he went to go talk a lot about sanctuary cities, of which Chicago is, for immigrants, and also the DACA Dreamers stuff. And Dreamers are immigrants who came as small children and infants, you know, with their parents illegally and have been living in the United States. And President Obama has created a situation so about 750,000 Dreamers are not going to be prosecuted, so they can go to school and they can have jobs and work towards
they
becoming
won't, they
citizens.
They don't have to be threats. There's no threats of deportation.
Right.
This was something that, that
right.
you know, was 3 years ago.
And it was
ago.
Done entirely by executive action. And so it, because of that, it's not force of law. And as soon – well, it's force of law, but as soon as Trump comes in, he can get rid of that, and then those people could be prosecuted and thrown out of the country. And so Rahm Emanuel went to say, hey, please don't do that. And it seems like maybe Trump is softening a bit. And he's said to some other people that he wants to find a solution for them. But, you know, let's talk about this on the other hand, which is that earlier this week, you know, Mr. Green Tree Hugger himself, Al Gore, went to go meet with Trump.
Absolutely. And, we just talked about that.
And, you know, he I'm sure he did his global warming.
We all thought, oh, there might be something here. You know,
right,
maybe this is
right.
He's softening.
And then this morning, Trump announced that he's appointing a guy who thinks that climate change is bunko as the head of EPA.
Well, I mean, there's a lot on the line for the city of Chicago, not immigration being one concept, because but essentially in the first 100 days plan that President-elect Donald Trump put out, he said any city that was a sanctuary, quote unquote, sanctuary city was going to lose federal funding.
Right.
So you're seeing cities like LA and New York and Chicago, which are sanctuary cities, trying to almost lobby, in a sense, President-elect Trump to say, you know, let's keep politics out of this. We're going to continue to be a sanctuary city. This is how it has been. Beyond that, though, there's a lot at stake for the city of Chicago. I mean, one thing they said that would be talked about was the finances, just the idea that Chicago has seen in the last year tax increases, changes in the way that we do things, services being cut, a really rocky relationship with its state government.
Right.
I mean, what can a federal president-elect like Donald Trump be able to do for the city of Chicago that would somehow come out in a meeting like this?
What could he do that's positive?
Yeah,
he could do a ton. I mean, you know, he could offer, apparently Emanuel says that they talked about transportation and infrastructure spending. And so, you know, Trump could get more money to cities in terms of infrastructure. They could help the city build more L lines. They could help the city improve. Well, we've improved the airports, but, you know, more highways, more spending on. We've got a lot of issues with trains around Chicago. Mm-hmm. Chicago is the big bottleneck for freight trains. That could be a big thing.
Any president anywhere, you know, at any time would see Chicago as a transportation hub and want to put federal funding in. This meeting's really about don't punish Chicago.
That's right. Right. That's right. But, you know, I think, though, the idea, the threat that President-elect Trump had to take away all federal funding for cities is really an empty threat. I mean, because that you do that, you're hurting everybody. And you're not just hurting the cities. It's a nice, line. But, you know, you start to really obliterate the cities around the country. Just Chicago, you know, it hurts. It hurts Republican Indiana. It hurts Republican Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. It hurts Republicans in Illinois. That's not a good thing. And there are Emanuel gave a letter signed by, I think, 17 mayors from around the country saying, please leave our sanctuary cities and please support Dreamers. And that included Houston, Nashville, included Denver. You know, those are cities in somewhat red states. You know, Houston, you know, Texas is a pretty red state. So I think the idea that you're going to punish all those cities is really not a real thing.
Mike Fouché is with thedailyline.net. Let's take a quick break so we stay on time. We'll continue the conversation. Let's talk about some issues closer to home.
Yeah.
Including one that has just been plaguing Chicago, honorary street signs.
Yeah, those brown signs.
We'll talk about more with Mike Fouché here on The Download after the break. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Mike Fouché in studio. He's here with us pretty much every Wednesday.
Yeah, I try.
Sometimes
I can't always make it.
Sometimes move it around.
Yeah, right.
But from the dailyline.net, also you can check out the podcast Aldercast.
The Aldercast on iTunes, Stitcher, WGN Plus.
80 Quig and
Claudia Morrell
on Fridays.
Yeah.
You can check it. So check that out through iTunes. All right. So, you know, before we get to the big story, which everyone wants to know about, the
Atterbury
Street Signs, let's talk about Chicago Public Schools because, you know, obviously last week, a huge blow with Governor Rauner vetoing the pension relief bill.
Right.
That was a handshake deal that was part of what we talked about in this program throughout the year. And, you know, that's at first you were like, well, you know, the House will come back to it. But then it became clear that the House didn't have enough votes. And it looks like that money that was promised, $215 million for pension relief, is just not going to be there.
No, no.
What does this do for Chicago Public Schools?
The thing is that that Chicago basically had – the Chicago Public Schools had basically said that this is the limit. They're at the red line, and that was really what they were at. I mean, they found – a way to squeak in with the budget. And there's some questions, you know, where are you really going to make it? You know, there'll be like 2 pennies left at the end of the year is the deal. And this $215 million, as it goes for, you know, budgets for Chicago, Chicago has like a $8 billion budget and CPS has like a $5 billion budget. $250 million is really nothing. But because they're maxed out in every way that they can, wow. You know, this is huge. This would be like if you had spent every last dime and then somebody comes to you and says, hey, man, you owe me 10 bucks.
You know, there's something to be said about over the years, I guess you say the last 2 years, we've seen Governor Rauner take a position and whether it's his words or people around him effectively saying that he'd like to see Chicago Public Schools sort of a file for bankruptcy to be somewhere where like to see more municipalities or to see more governmental entities do bankruptcy like a business.
Yeah.
That's been shot down by the fact that, you know, there's a lot that could happen in that doesn't apply to the way schools are run.
More importantly,
but is that what this is about? I mean, is he doing that?
Good question. More importantly, a couple of years before he ran for governor is that he gave a speech at a think tank about how the way to be able to make change in Illinois is to drive a wedge between Democrats and the social programs that they love. And he used that term, you know, Democrats and the social programs that I think that he said that they hold dear or something like that. And, you know, he's doing it right here with CPS. And there are really no serious Republican voting blocks in Chicago that could harm him. So he can just dump on Chicago as much as he wants. He goes around the state telling people how bad Chicago is. And everybody around the state goes, yeah. And he also believes that the teachers union is not a good outfit. And so he believes that teachers are overpaid and that CPS needs to be shrunk and that it's a bloated bureaucracy. That's what he believes. Now, you know, those of us who have kids in CPS, I know you do and I do, you know, maybe we see things a little differently. But his plan is to be, you know, I think is to try and make it as difficult as possible for Chicago. And he is step by step making it so that Chicago has to pay for things itself. That just happened last week with the red line
stuff.
Expansion.
Let me ask you, though. I mean, it's a very small story, but it's interesting about CPS wanting to use, essentially when issuing a new kind of bond that talks about
hypothetical
bankruptcy. Yeah, now, what is that? I mean, are we getting closer and closer to the vision that Governor Rauner kind of laid out about what to do with failing municipalities?
So they want to be able to do a whole bunch of capital improvements to schools across the city. And so it's they passed a special tax, actually a capital spending tax. Actually, the city council passed this. So it's paid through a different route, not CPS, but city council. And they want to bond that spending. And that's not unusual, so you can get all the cash up front. But what they had to put in was the possibility of a, quote, hypothetical bankruptcy in the documents that they're floating to try and get bonds.
And that's new.
That's new.
Yeah.
I mean, really, the idea of saying a hypothetical bankruptcy to an investor is really kind of like, you know.
This is not usually what you want to say to an investor.
No, no. I mean, hey, you know, can you lend me some money? I might go bankrupt. You know, that's not really something that's too crazy. And that's new language. So they're going to try and float those bonds, and we'll see what people say.
Well, we'll continue to talk about that, especially coming up here in 2017 as, you know, as it gets more serious when the lawmakers are back in session and you really start to feel the brunt of not having that pension relief.
Right.
The last story, we've been teasing it out
all hour. Wow. Yeah. Do you say it?
The city council today spent an inordinate amount of time arguing and debating and really pushing the limits of democracy, democracy, over whether or not we should continue the practice of honorary street signs.
Yeah, well, no, not to whether or not to continue, but to curtail it, you know, because right now there's basically, you know, those brown signs.
Curtail it.
So there's like, you know, I think that we should have a Justin Kaufman way, you know, so if we were going to have Justin Kaufman way, we'd make this corner of Michigan Avenue Justin Kaufman way. And so the chair of the Transportation Committee put together a bill, an ordinance to try and curtail this so that if you're going to put it up, it can only be for 5 years. Every alderman can do one only two a year, and then they got to pay for it out of their aldermanic menu money. and you know, CDOT really hates
I'm sorry
these.
I'm laughing, but just the concept of that specifically, I mean, aldermen are rubber stamping budgets and talk.
Yeah, I know.
This is the one thing they get. And they get to do honorary street signs.
That's exactly right. I mean, if you want to have an honorary street sign, there's one guy who can do it.
Right.
Who's your alderman? And so you got to go in on your knees and you say, oh, Godfather, I have my honorary street sign. And so, you know, they really like that. That's important to them. CDOT hates it because they get them at the last
Department
minute.
Of Transportation.
Yeah, and they got to drop everything and go put up this silly sign. The Trump sign is one of them. And, you know, that they finally took down. So, you know, this is something that they care a lot about, and they argue for an hour. And then at the end of the hour, the chair of the committee said, all right, well, looking around, I don't think there's enough votes in order to move this out of committee. So he held the ordinance. So
you know you're getting close to holiday season when this becomes, you know what, if we can get another 25 minutes of debate on this issue.
Wow.
I mean, they did, what'd you say, an hour?
An hour. An hour. I know. It's like our reporter who was there, she's like, I can't believe there was this much to talk about. You know,
or not enough to talk about in this case, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So, Mike Fouché, the podcast is Aldercast.
The Aldercast on iTunes, Stitcher, and WGN Plus comes out every Friday afternoon. It's about 10 minutes long. It's highly produced. 80 Quig, Claudia Morell, two sharp women covering City Hall. They're radio veterans, so they really know how to put together a great podcast.
It's getting some traction, too. I'm starting to see it everywhere, so that's good.
Yeah, it's great.
All right. Mike Fouché, he runs the dailyline.net. He joins us here on Wednesdays right before taxi driver Bob said they're going to rename Lower Wacker Drive Justin Kaufman Way right over the cardboard boxes. That's what he said.
That's the Walter Jacobson section.
I'll take it.
When he did that.
I'll take it. You know, I can do a lot with that area. Just as long as I can bring a marching band and cut a ribbon. I need to cut a ribbon. I need oversized scissors to cut the ribbon. There's a lot that I specifically need for Justin Kaufman
Way. We can do
that. But yeah. Mike, great to see you, buddy.
Good to be here.
Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up a little bit later, we're going to talk with poet, activist, and now hip-hop artist Malcolm London. Malcolm London is an unbelievable artist. And he also is an activist who led a lot of the Black Lives Matter protests after Laquan McDonald's, the shooting death and the video release of Laquan McDonald. And he actually was in the headlines because he was arrested. And it was one of those issues that, and I don't have all the specifics in front of me, but it was one of those issues where there was a dispute on whether or not he did what the police said he did. The protesters went down to the police station. They protested in front, and after negotiation, he was released without incident. So it's interesting, Malcolm London making a transition from being a leader of the protest movement into more art. And being able to use that as activism at a broader stage. He put out his new album, which just came out last month. So we'll talk with Malcolm London as well. Tonight, Sam Panionovich will also join us a little bit later to talk about the White Sox. Yes, yes, yes. watching every year they pick up a grizzled veteran to come in and plug that one hole, and now it's all right, and then they end up playing C-plus baseball. It's great to see them actually make a move to, you know, it's going to be tough to not have Chris Sale and Adam Eaton, but at the same time, great to have a lot of young, really impressive talent that could be something special on the south side. So we'll talk with Sam Panayotovich about what the new players look like, but also what might still be in store for the Chicago White Sox. So that's all coming up tonight on The Download. Well, today is the 75th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. The surprise attack on the Pacific Fleet left thousands of Americans dead and led to the declaration of war by President Roosevelt the next day, our official entry into World War II. Roosevelt called December 7, 1941, the date that will live in infamy. The attack still is held up as one of the darkest days in American history, but out of the attack and the subsequent war in the Pacific came another infamous and dark moment in American history, one that's not talked about as much. And I'm referring to the United States' decision to move Japanese Americans from the West Coast to internment camps for the duration of the war. 109,000 Japanese Americans were removed and transplanted from their homes in fear of aiding the Japanese. They were transported to camps inland in places like Wyoming and even as far east as Arkansas. A new book chronicles that history and showcases amazing War Relocation Authority photography that documented the move. I mean, it really is amazing photography. The book is called Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II, and the authors are Chicagoans Richard Cahan and Michael Williams. The duo have worked together on several projects, and Richard Cahan, a former picture editor at the Chicago Sun-Times, joins me tonight. Rich, good to see you.
Thanks, Justin.
Thanks for being here. This is a tremendous, tremendous book. And you as a photographer and a great photographer, this is more archive than it is your photography, obviously. But talk about what it means to put a book like this together from stuff that is available to the public.
Well, the photography is eye-opening. The book is primarily photographs that were taken by Dorothea Lange, who is one of the great documentary photographers of the 20th century. And Ansel Adams, who I would think most listeners are familiar with, kind of a scenic landscape artist. But Ansel Adams was allowed to go into camps. He was authorized to go into camps, and he made an incredible portfolio of people in the camps and the landscape around it.
It's so interesting. But let's talk about the history of this story.
Sure.
You know, after the attack on Pearl Harbor, there were concerns about the Japanese-American community. And when we say Japanese-American community, there wasn't sort of immigration status yet. I mean, this was 1941, so there wasn't a law that was passed till the 50s about whether, you know, so there was still, these were first-generation Japanese that were here, maybe second-generation.
Exactly.
But it wasn't as organized as we know it today.
Right. It wasn't easy to be a Japanese-American during those years. Japanese emigrated to America starting in the late 1800s, and from the very beginning there were immigration laws that were prevented them from owning land, that prevented them from becoming citizens. So all of the first generation Japanese, none of them were citizens. All of their children who were born in America, 70,000 of them, were American citizens, and they were the majority, two-thirds of the people that were picked up, forced from their homes, and sent to detention centers, most of them for the duration, almost 3 years, of the war. So imagine taking U.S. citizens away.
It's, you know, and in the history of it, the first couple months, because it really started in the spring of 1942, but the first couple months after Pearl Harbor,
there was
almost an ease that the federal government was not going to do this. There was a little bit of comfort for the Japanese American community. They felt like, you know, they were sort of, the FBI had kind of said, no, this is not a threat. There was some, it really felt like this wasn't on the table.
Right. Actually, Pearl Harbor started the FBI's first advance, and within 48 hours, they arrested over 1,000 Japanese Americans. None of them were citizens, but
leaders of the community.
They were suspects. So if you taught in Japanese language schools, you would be arrested. If you were a leader of chamber of commerces, you know, they picked off all the leaders, and that really crippled the community. Imagine 1,000 families without a head of household. But the thought was that this is America.
And they did that also for German, for Italian, like everyone who was essentially the
enemy. Yes, but a much smaller number.
Right.
The Japanese Americans were, they were suspect because Japan had started the war. There was worries that there was going to be an attack on California. And there was a worry that the Japanese Americans that lived in America were both spies and they would collaborate. there was absolutely no evidence against them.
And the FBI pretty much said that at a certain point. They came out, they're like, we're all, everything that we're worried about is not actually happening.
Exactly.
Except as time moved on, there was, not unlike we see here in this country now, there was a public move, editorials, right, newspapers. There started to be a Japanese backlash that became more and more sort of in the mainstream.
Yeah, I think that this book and the incarceration is really about hysteria. And it's a word that I think we have to be aware of even today. There's a lot of hysteria going on in the country today. And one thing that I learned from the story is that you never make good decisions when you're hysterical. It takes away our rational way of thinking, and that's a key takeaway from this.
But even though the FBI and other officials said this really isn't a threat, the hysteria went all the way up to the White House, where President Roosevelt gave the authority to the military to make the decision on what they wanted to do.
It was amazing that the case that was built against the Japanese, one of the villains of this book is Earl Warren, who's considered a liberal. He was the head of the Supreme Court in the 1950s, but he was attorney general in California at the time. And I think he was taking advantage of the fact that he could whip up this hysteria. So he made a map of every Japanese resident living in California. And he showed this Senate subcommittee how close they were to airports.
To oil fields.
To oil fields.
Right.
To ports. To radio stations.
Military operations.
It's like making a map now and saying, look, there are Muslims that live near O'Hare Airport.
Yeah. And they're living there on purpose because they're getting ready for the impending attack.
Exactly.
Right.
And so when government officials asked him, you know, there's been no reports. There's been no sabotage. There's been no collaboration. He said, exactly. That just shows you how dangerous they are, because they're so dangerous that they've kept this all under wraps.
So then the military got involved, and that's when it started.
Yeah. Another villain I have to say is President Roosevelt. Less than 11 weeks after Pearl Harbor, he basically left the decision of what to do with the Japanese to the Army. The Army was not concerned about the civil rights of Americans. They were asked to be sure that America was safe. So their kind of Army answer was, let's send them all to concentration camps.
And those camps were set up temporary and permanent, but they were set up. They were essentially Central California all the way into the Wyoming sort of area. And like I said in the lead, almost all the way east to Arkansas. I mean, the idea was to get them as far away from the Pacific Ocean as possible.
Right. And really to give them land that was, they certainly didn't want to give them valuable land. So they ended up mostly in deserts, and in Arkansas it was almost a forest. It was the farthest you could get land that was connected to railroads, because they needed the railroads to ship these people out.
Richard Cahan is the author, co-author of Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II, tremendous photography from the War Relocation Authority. Right. And we'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll get into that, because, you know, the foresight, and I don't know if it was actually intentional or it was an accident, but to put these photographers on the transition or the essential evacuation's a bad word. That's what they want to call it, evacuation. Right. But the forced removal.
Exactly.
The forced removal of Japanese Americans was stunning for the content that it has produced. Richard Cahan in studio. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest at the big table tonight, Richard Cahan. He's the co-author of Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II. It really feels this book, which you can get anywhere. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it at bookstores. You can get it at cityfilespress.com. It reads, it's part history lesson. It's part photography, of course, and it's also, I mean, the amount of content that you produce that's new, where you actually reach out to the kids and some of the people who are in these photography, it's amazing. I mean, to hear their stories about what their experiences were like.
Yeah, these photos, we found them about a year ago in the National Archives in College Park, Maryland. They've been around. They've illustrated books, and you know, they've been shown one at a time. But this is the first real comprehensive look at these photos. And I think that you can keep talking about the internment and what happened, but until you see photos, you know, we kind of use photos as evidence. Mm-hmm. And once you see it, you understand it much better. You understand that these were not these were Americans that wore leather belts and had you know, check shirts, and they were just picked up, and you see it all in these films.
It really is. It grabs your attention when you see a family in front of almost a picket fence California home that, you know, as American as you can get, right. And then juxtaposed to these, stark images of trains, you know, going to relocation centers in Los Angeles, and talking essentially about these being concentration camps. History redefines these. They changed the words because of what happened in Eastern Europe.
Right.
But the idea, they were even called concentration camps to begin with.
Exactly. And that's exactly what they were. They were concentrating a part of America. And I think that's what keeps striking me, that once we start segregating Americans and saying, you register and you don't register, that's when the true character of America starts breaking down. Mm-hmm. It certainly broke down during World War II.
A lot of this, the book is around some tremendous photographers. We mentioned Ansel Adams and also government photographers from the War Relocation Authority. Talk about the War Relocation Authority's mission here. I mean, the idea to hire photographers to document this transition seems a little head-scratching because, you know, in history, in hindsight, you're like, that's almost like a black eye on the American experience.
Right.
But at the time, they went to a lot of lengths to be able to get this documented.
They did. And I guess we should say what the War Relocation Authority was something that was started in 1942, and it's exactly what it sounds like. Their job was to relocate people from California, Japanese Americans from California to the interior of the country. Relocation is a bad word. It sounds like, you know, you've just gotten a new job and you're relocating.
Yeah.
But they were really, as we said, responsible for the forced removal. I think that they thought that photography was very important because they wanted to show Americans and they wanted to show the world how the whole process was working. By hiring photographers, they could also keep other photographers out. They could say to newspaper photographers and magazine photographers,
We've got it covered. Right.
We'll provide you with imagery. And, of course, the imagery that they provided them was only imagery that they wanted to provide. So I think that the story also harkens back or really talks about the importance of a free press. And as soon as government officials say, oh, there's no need for the press to follow me or there's no need for, you know, the press to cover that, we'll provide the information, I think people should get really suspect.
Yeah, right. There's some written Dorothea Lange, and telling her story as one of the photographers. You know, she had moments in even telling the story or retelling the story of, you know, having being sick to her stomach or having anxiety off of what was happening to these people. It almost feels like the War Relocation Authority got more than they bargained for by hiring this woman to be the photographer because she did such a tremendous job humanizing these people.
They had no idea what they were getting. People should know Dorothea Lange because she took the very famous picture of the migrant mother and she documented the Okies moving to California, and she's really well known as a Farm Security Administration photographer. So she had worked for the government in the 30s, and it seems like there's no direct evidence that she was the one that convinced the government that it was important to document this. As you said, I don't think they had any idea what they were getting into. But for Dorothea Lange, she did become ill. She developed ulcers during this process, and she only really worked for 3 or 4 months documenting Japanese Americans. But the record she left behind is extraordinary.
Well, you could tell because the way she would do some of the photography is she would go and get the sort of starting point. She'd get the families at their homes that were left behind in California that people never came back to.
Exactly.
And then
to come back to.
They had nothing to come back to.
They were given basically a week to get rid of all their belongings, to sell their house,
take
to figure out
carry,
the, yeah,
right.
to sell their cars, to and just to take what they could carry. And Dorothea Lange had the insight to photograph these people in their homes and standing in front of their homes and playing the game of go on the last day that they were going to be picked up and their bags and packages are all put around the room. She's known as one of the great documentarians of the 20th century, but when we went through the photographs, we could see what she took every day, and we were astounded. We did a book on Vivian Meyer, who's a great photographer. Dorothea Lange was I won't say, I mean, she was at a class by herself that she could do this.
And I mean, beyond her work and others as well, I mean, because there were a lot of government photographers that were involved. But some of the heartbreaking stuff that you see, like when you see all the packages kind of like just thrown or everybody's stuff, mountains of bags, you know, with numbers on. I mean, it really does. It conjures up imagery that is so negative in the way that we know from Eastern European concentration camps and the Holocaust. It's just so – it's just that it's a malaise over this when you see this photography and you realize this happened in this country.
Yeah, just imagine that if somebody said you've got a week to pack up and didn't tell them where they were going. They had no idea when they reported. They had no idea how long they would be gone. They didn't know if it was going to be a week. They didn't know if it was going to be the rest of the war. They didn't know it was going to be forever. So the angst that came back. We started the book with this remarkable quote by one of the survivors, who's now the poet laureate of Oregon, Lawson Inada. And he wrote, I love this quote, "Only what we could carry was the rule. So we carried strength, dignity, and soul." And I think that's really what this book is all about, how they responded.
Co-author Richard Cahan in studio, Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II, great book with interviews as well as photography and the story of the Japanese American internment camps during World War II. We'll take a quick break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back, and I want to talk about tracking some of these people down, the process of finding these people and what they had to say about their memories and their history in this sordid time. Richard Cahan in studio. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Download here on 720 WGN Radio. My guest at the big table tonight, Richard Cahan. He's the co-author of Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II. We're talking about the internment camps that the U.S. government put Japanese Americans in after the declaration of war. A couple months after the declaration of war, what happened in Pearl Harbor? It's the 75th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor today. You know, it's such an interesting book because the photography really is the lead. I mean, you're seeing some of these tremendous iconic photographers be able to use their artistry to really document this moment in time. But it's also, you guys add to it, and you add to it by focusing on and identifying some of the people that some of the kids and people who are younger who may still be alive and tracking them down.
Right. We have about 170 pictures in the book. They span the gamut from, as you mentioned, life in the Japanese-American community before all this happened, to the days that they were picked up, to the early days in the assembly centers, the temporary camps, and then the permanent camps, and then coming home again. We picked the pictures because of kind of artistic reasons and historical reasons, but then we decided that we were going to try to find out the story behind every picture. Most of the pictures are crowd scenes, so we didn't. But there's about 30 pictures that we wanted to find out who these people were.
They're like families of five, things like that.
Families of five, or sometimes it's an individual portrait. And there wasn't a lot to go on. This was a fluid situation. People were moving fast, and captions that the original photographers left are very spare. But we had lots of ammunition, and we figured out 25 of those 30 people.
Wow.
One way we figured them out is, and this sounds strange, they were wearing tags on the day they were taken away, and they had numbers. And we had a list of those numbers. So as soon as we saw a number, we knew what family they were in. And once we found the family, it was a matter of really...
So you would just sort of go against the database that you found and all
So somebody was wearing a certain number, and we could go, we could figure out what family they were in, and then it was a matter of really just tracking down the family and looking through obituaries and look through... Sometimes it was people that were on the scene
when you reached out, and the stories are in the book, but, I mean, were they excited, hesitant? I mean, what were the emotions that you encountered in trying to talk to them about this experience?
People say that Japanese Americans, like people who lived through the Holocaust in Europe, were very hesitant to talk about their stories when they came back. Remember, all these people are at least 75 years old, because it was 75 years ago. Basically, the people I talked to were between 75 and 95. And everybody that we talked to felt a responsibility to share their story and to tell their story. That said, this wasn't without challenge. When I figured out the phone numbers of these people, I would call them And like most 75-year-olds or 80-year-olds old, the first thing they did was hang up the phone before I could say my name is Rich Cahan, a journalist, thinking it was a telemarketer.
Yeah.
So the process was almost always the same. I would have to wait to a strange hour, and then I would leave a message on their phone machine, and then I'd wait a couple days and call them back. And when I called them back to the person, they were very happy to tell their story. Sometimes they had no idea that they were photographed. Remember, these photographs were taken 75 years ago. Sometimes they remembered the day when Dorothea Lange showed up at their family farm. One woman told me that this picture wasn't in front of her, but she remembers that her father was very upset because they couldn't find the shoes of her one-year-old sister, and the father didn't want the family to look like hicks from a farm. And I take a careful look at the picture, and there's this little one-year-old in her arms, and she has no shoes. So sometimes they remembered to the day when it was taken. Other times, they had absolutely no idea that they were ever
found. Now, one of the storylines that you – it's in the book, and it's also just in history, is that when the internment camps – when it was up,
right.
when they said, okay, you know, the war is over, right. you can go back – there wasn't a lot to go back to,
yeah.
And a lot of Japanese Americans just chose not. They just didn't go back to their homes. They didn't go back to their businesses. They decided to go elsewhere.
Right. California for many people was a scary place. They remembered the weeks before the trains came to them. I talked about the hysteria. There was real hatred. One of the lessons that I learned from this book is that we Americans, I'm sure it's every country, have a problem figuring out who our actual enemy is. You know, the enemy of World War II was the governments and the people of Germany and the people of Japan and the people of the Axis nations. They weren't the Germans and the Italians and the Japanese Americans that lived in this country. So I think it's really important to understand that people who come from countries aren't the enemies. It's the countries themselves. Mm-hmm. So people were reticent about going back. They lost their farms. They lost their livelihood. So as it so happens, Chicago became a center for a lot of people. Chicago had about 200 or 300 Japanese Americans when the war started, and by 1948 and 49, they had 20,000.
Wow.
So Chicago plays an important part of the story.
It's a story that, and you kind of just mentioned it, you know, about separating the people from the government or from the country. And it's a story that we've heard more about in the last month and a half, right. when we talk about a possible Muslim registry, which gets scrolled across CNN. But this concept of even the Syrian refugee crisis, where people are coming in and there wants to be some check on who these people are, and this sort of hidden terrorism idea. You know, as you work on this project and you finish this project, those lessons, you know, that the lessons around hysteria or what you learned about what happened in 1941 to 1946, I mean, it's different, but it's the same.
Yeah, this book, we didn't realize how relevant the book was going to be when we worked on it last year, but this book has become very relevant to people. There is actual talk about registries of Muslims, and talk about how the internment camp is a precedent for this. Well, it's the opposite of a precedent. It's a road we took. It's pretty clear from the pictures and from all the evidence that it was the wrong road. And that's why we called the book Un-American. Mm-hmm. There are people to this day who argue that the security of the country trumps,
wartime is wartime.
Wartime is wartime. But what we did during this time was un-American.
You hear today, I heard in the newscast, one of Judy's newscasts earlier, just this concept. I heard a veteran talking about there was no formal apology from Japan,
right.
for the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Has the U.S. government ever stepped up and issued any formal apology to the Japanese-American community?
They did. During the Reagan and Ford administrations, there was a formal apology, and every Japanese-American who lived through it received a $20,000 reparation payment. And I asked everyone what they did with the payment. Usually it was to pay for their kids' college education, but sometimes it was to go to a scholarship fund for other, you know, other Japanese-Americans or other – actually, it wasn't Japanese-Americans. It was – refugees who'd come to this country, and these people thought it was very important. Apologies are important, but just as important are the lessons that come from this.
You know, as you think about, and one of the things I took from the book was just the way the hysteria led to the haste of this sort of happening, meaning this became really like a war time exercise, right, in the way that they were able to really make these relocations happen.
Right.
You know, it makes you think about, well, there's part of me when I'm reading, I'm like, there's no way that this could happen this way. But there was something about the way that the military ran the operation that makes you think that this country could do it again like that.
That's a really good question. One thing I'll say is, you remember what happened the day after 9/11? We as people had a whole different worldview after 9/11. Things happen. Hysteria happens when we're worried about security. There's something about human beings and Americans. I'm sure all human beings who operate irrationally when they're scared.
Yeah. Co-author Richard Cahan, the former picture editor at the Chicago Sun-Times, his book is Un-American: The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II. Features images from photographers Dorothea Lange, Ansel Adams, other government photographers. And the one thing I didn't ask, and I thought it was great with the sort of statement at the top of the book, is in this day and age with the ability to edit photos and programs and do all the things that you could do to photos, you made the conscious decision to present these as is with the edges and the way that they were. You didn't crop. You didn't change the environment of the picture. You sort of were, you know, you wanted to almost... you wanted to give it as it was.
Yeah, frame to frame. And by showing it frame to frame, we learned an awful lot, including little marks that photographers left that helped us find people. So.
You can find the book on Amazon, other places that sell books, cityfilespress.com. Richard, thanks.
And bookstores.
And bookstores. What are those? We're going to do a segment on those at some point. Great to see you. Thanks for coming in. Thanks for the book.
Thank you.
Your family and friends could hear your voice on 720 AM. We're giving you an exclusive opportunity to get behind the mic here at WGN Radio, thanks to Allstate. You could tour the WGN Radio studios, introduce the news, and have a part in our holiday radio show, A Christmas Carol, on Friday, December 16th. Still waiting for the casting list on that one. I don't know if I told you, Pete, but I auditioned. But this is kind of an interesting story. You know, my son has been in the last couple of plays. I think I've talked about it here on the show. And this year they were talking about doing a play, and they wanted to do, I think the talk was they were going to do Grease. I was like, okay. But the teacher rewrites it. I guess like they're in, you know, middle school. So I was like, yeah, because Grease, I mean, just a Kinnicky Rizzo part. I'm not pregnant. I didn't get any candy. Like, how do you change that? So anyway, my son was like, well, I don't know who I'm going to play. And I'm like, well, you should play Danny. You should audition for Danny. And he was like, well, I don't know. I don't know if I'm cool enough to play Danny. And I was like, what do you mean you're not cool enough? He's like, one of the girls in the school said I don't have enough swag to play Danny. I was like, it's swagger. It's not swag. Swag is what you get from the Oscars. That's cologne and lotion. But I was, so, you know, he told me that, and I like really was like, no, you got to try and be, you got to go for the, you got to go for the lead, man.
Aim for the top.
You got to aim for the top. And so I took my own advice. I went into the audition, and I said, I want to be Scrooge on this play.
Oh.
And that's a big, you know, you got Cochran, you got Rokan, Bill and Wendy, Orion Samuelson. Everybody else down the line is probably going to be a better fit for Scrooge. But I'm like, nah, I'm auditioning for the role of Scrooge. Don't you dare. If I become like turkey guy number four, like, thanks, Scrooge, for this turkey. It's, you know, the play we do is every year. Last year we did Miracle on 34th Street, wasn't that right? Did we change it? Miracle on 720 or something like that?
It was somebody who left. Carol? Something, you know, Carol Hanker, who was here.
Right.
I think it was something like that. Miracle on Carol Hanker Street or something like that. She was, you know, Jimmy's assistant for those many years, something like that.
Yeah. I played Mr. Macy in that play.
Yeah, and you killed it, as I recall.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for that. I appreciate that. And so I feel like it's time to move up, you know. And so I went in there and I said, I'm going to be Scrooge. So we'll see.
And you read for Scrooge and they said, okay. They didn't call you back to say, okay, we want you to try to read for this other part.
No, they did not call me back. There were no callbacks. Hmm. I kind of came in and like a whirlwind. I was like, I'm doing this. Right? I came in quick. I was like, this is what we're doing. I'm going to read for Scrooge. I can do a bunch of accents if you want it to be, you know, name it. I said, I can do a British accent.
Yeah, that's
key. I can
do
French if you want to make it a French Scrooge. I could do like a Brazilian Scrooge. You know, a lot of different. I don't know. I don't know if we're doing like a new theme, if it's a contemporary
theme.
Yeah,
you just want to show, you should want to show you're real.
Right. It was Miracle on Jerry Wells Street.
Oh, Jerry Wells. Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, of course. So for me, I feel like, I feel like it's Scrooge or nothing. Like I may be in one of those situations where when they give Scrooge this to Cochran, I should be like, well, I'm out. I should be.
Well, what are the main roles? I guess, you know, it's.
Well, there's going to be the ghost of Christmas past, Christmas present, Christmas future. Although one of those just points, right? Ooh, I could do that. There's Tiny Tim.
Yeah,
Bob Cratchit.
That's a big line, Tiny Tim.
I think there's a couple of like Scrooge's lady that he passed on, right? He was really in love, but then he got really into money. I could be like one of I'd also settle for like one of Scrooge's like accountants. But sir, you're spending too much money on these turkeys.
That's good.
Yeah, I can do a lot.
You can do multiple roles.
I feel like if they just wanted to make it the one man show. You know, A Christmas Carol with Justin Kaufman, the one-man show, I could do all the roles. But Scrooge could be great. Listen to that. You hear that, like, evilness? Yes, it's the humbug.
Forget GN, man. Go Goodman
with
this.
I know. Give Larry Yando a run for his money.
Yeah.
Or, like, set up across the street and just do it on the street corner. Like, do it in front of McDonald's there on the Randolph, right in front of the Goodman. You know, for competition, healthy competition.
Yeah.
I feel like that would
be a cheaper ticket.
Yeah. Anyway, go to WGNradio.com/contest and enter for your chance to get a taste of what it's like to broadcast. Again, that's WGNradio.com/contest. You come down for the holiday radio show and you get a tour of the station. You get to get on the air. It's all sponsored by Allstate, Chicago's own good hands. Yes. And I don't even know much about, I don't have any, you know, most of my inspiration is from the Scrooge McDuck. Remember DuckTales? They did A Christmas Carol, you know, where the Scrooge McDuck was the, you know, like that's more my speed. You actually put the Dickens script in front of me. I don't know what these words mean. If you show me a cartoon duck, I'm like, I can do Scrooge McDuck, right? I think Donald's in that one. Hey, Uncle. I couldn't even do it. So all that coming up on the 16th of December. I'm excited about it. It's always fun, though. They do it in Campbell Hall.
Yeah, it's great.
It'll be fun. People come down. It's so fun to do live, like, theater.
Yeah.
Radio theater.
And, Duffy does, like, all the, you know, he does all the production, and, like, he's the announcer, and he makes it very old-timey.
Good. He's so good. All that's so good. All right, so that's coming up on the 16th. All right, coming up this hour... author and therapist Kelly Kitley is going to be here. We're going to talk about her new autobiography, Myself. It's an interesting story that, you know, she talks about growing up in Chicago and sort of the some of the obstacles she had to overcome to have a healthy adult life. And it's really interesting to me because she works in psychotherapy. She's a therapist. She works with a lot of issues. And I always wonder whenever you deal with any sort of therapist, if you're like, does this person even have any concept of what I'm going through? Kelly does. She's lived it. So she'll be my guest coming up here after 9 o'clock. And also Malcolm London, the activist, poet, and now musician. His new album, Opia, is out in stores. So that's all coming up this hour on The Download. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. Welcome back to The Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, Malcolm London's going to be here. We'll talk about his debut album. Malcolm London's been a longtime poet, young Chicago author's kid who I think didn't he, wasn't he, I think he was a Louder Than a Bomb guy. He won a ton of poetry contests. He was actually, he went to present to the United Nations. He was with the activism group We Charge Genocide, which was really about police brutality and issues in Chicago. And he went to the United Nations. This is about 5 years ago now. And they actually listened to the what they presented, and they made a ruling saying what was happening in Chicago was a human rights violation. And it kind of – he was the one of the young kids, I mean, at 19, 20, maybe younger than that, wow, who was in front of, you know, the United Nations making this presentation. So Malcolm London is a great artist, and he has taken his poetry to music. He's got a new album out, so we'll talk to him and listen to some of the music that he's putting together coming up here. And also Sam Panayanovich will join us to talk about the Chicago White Sox, who are in a rebuilding effort, which makes me smile. I'm glad to see that they're doing something. I mean, they're assessing or accumulating a tremendous amount of talent, whether or not that is potential talent or we'll see it on the field. We'll talk to Sam about what we can expect from the Chicago White Sox for years to come, coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. Well, my next guest is a longtime social worker and psychotherapist here in Chicago. Kelly Kitley is a licensed therapist who runs her own practice called Kelly Kitley Serendipitous Psychotherapy. She focuses mainly on women's issues with pre- and postnatal depression, but also mental health issues as well as sexual dysfunction. And starting this Christmas, she will be a published author. Kelly just put out her autobiography, her memoir, called Myself, which explores her life as a child of divorce with other issues like sexual assault, eating disorders, and addiction. But while this is a story of obstacles, it's also a story of how to overcome obstacles and how as adults we can find the strength and resolve from the experiences in our past. It's my pleasure to welcome Kelly Kitley to the program. Kelly, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm fascinated by this because we were kind of talking, Pete and I were talking about the idea of, you know, a lot of people will go to therapy and they'll be with their therapist and they're like, I'm not sure this person understands me. In this case, I mean, reading about your story and reading your autobiography, there's probably a good chance you do. You had a lot of trauma in your life.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Why write an autobiography about it?
It was such a healing process for me, and I've always had a journal since I was 12. And wanting to write a book was always a long-term goal for me, but I didn't know what I wanted it to be about. And after my second child was born about 8 years ago, my husband took the kids to Jersey to see his parents, and I had a lot of downtime. And so I thought, well, this is a good opportunity to start. So I started digging out old journals and really highlighting themes throughout my life. And it just started to unfold. And so it's something that I've picked up on and off again over the last 8 years. Mm-hmm. And we're ready to launch.
Well, for you, I mean, as a therapist, you know, when you have relationships with patients, a lot of times, you know, all the time, really, patients, it's their stories and you're there to mm-hmm. help them with the problems that they have. And they're not aware of some of the problems that you may bring to the table because that's not usually how therapy works. How therapeutic has this book been for you? I mean, to think about as a therapist being able to tell your story on the page, mm-hmm. that has to have some therapeutic value.
Well, certainly I practice what I preach, so I've had lots of my own therapy, and this book was a process that I could have never imagined. I mean, there were days where I'd be sobbing and writing and put it away and pick it back up, and it was just such a beautiful way for me to look at my life from start to where I am today as a 38-year-old woman, and it has been immensely therapeutic for me. Writing is something that I encourage all of my patients to do in terms of keeping a journal, logging different behaviors and thoughts. And I encourage everybody to own and write their own story. I don't encourage them to necessarily share it with the world as I'm doing, but getting to know it and really owning it is so important.
Well, I mean, the story starts, you know, about in your life being living above a bar mm-hmm. with your family, a bar here in Chicago, a long-serving tavern here on the north side of Chicago. And it goes through your life and the challenges and the obstacles you have. I mean, for you, let's start there. Let's start with the tavern. I mean, as you think about that life, mm-hmm. you know, and some of the challenges you've had in your life when it comes to drinking mm-hmm. and addiction, mm-hmm. when you think about sort of your family owning and operating a bar, living in that environment, there are some threads that come out of that into what's happened to you in your life.
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, it wasn't all bad. And there's so much of the story that is funny and that, you know, the bar was an extension of our family. And so the regulars that came in and the parents of my friends who would go and drink, and alcohol was really so normalized for me at a really young age. And so, you know, throughout my life and my drinking career, I always surrounded myself with people who liked to party as well. And it was just a norm. And I didn't really think there was anything wrong with it, because in my world, everybody partied pretty hard. And growing up in that neighborhood and in that environment, because I worked there, I managed there. And it wasn't until my drinking had taken its course after I had four kids and had decided to get sober.
You know, for you, I'm interested as the threads in this book. I mean, whether it be anything surrounding the divorce of your parents when you were at a young age, or the eating disorder, or mm-hmm. even some of the sexual assault stuff that happened in your life. Are you able as a therapist to sort of piece together sort of why you act a certain way based on what happened to you more than sort of the regular person? Like, I mean, if I go to a therapist, I'm like, and they go, well, you know, this is what happened when you were 12. I'm like, I never thought about that. But when you're actually writing a book about your experience, I mean, yeah. you've been able to tie these things to the way to who you are and how
Absolutely.
You became who you are.
Yeah. Self-analysis for sure. And insightful thinking, and sometimes to a fault. But, you know, a lot of it was just not liking myself. And a lot of it was seeking validation and a connection with my dad and trying to do better and be better and get his attention. And a lot of that came from being really self-destructive with the eating disorder and, you know, surviving a sexual abuse situation and then kind of masking the feelings with that, with eating mm-hmm. disordered stuff. And, you know, I have an addictive personality, so I like to say I don't really have one of anything. So that's kind of a thread throughout, and whatever vice it was, it worked for me at that time to soothe and to not have to feel. And so once I started learning to like myself and to not seek outside validation, my life completely changed.
A lot of the issues in the book, which is called Myself, the author Kelly Kitley is in studio. She's a licensed therapist. She runs her own practice called Kelly Kitley Serendipitous Psychotherapy here in Chicago. I mean, a lot of the issues in the book are, I guess, issues that a lot of people will obviously identify mm-hmm. with, but they struggle to either come forward and have it be something that identifies themselves, meaning they maybe go to a therapist and they say, I don't have a drinking problem mm-hmm. or, you know, things of that nature. For you to be able to write this and make all of your sort of taboo subjects public, mm-hmm. does that make you a better therapist? Does that make you sort of a have a better understanding of the work that you do?
I guess it depends on who you ask. I would definitely say it does. You know, people that I work with, you know, the focus isn't on me, but there is a certain level of empathy and a wide range of experience that I've had that I feel that, you know, as a having gone through some things personally as well as being a trained professional, it's kind of the best of both worlds. And really the experiential learning from a young age and then being able to study that. And almost everything I talk about is very shaming in terms of the things that I've experienced.
Shame plays a big role in the book.
Yeah.
I mean, you come back to that, this idea of like, you know, whether it be, you know, and I only, you know, specifically bring things up, but like the handyman or other things in the book, the shame of the experience seems to almost be the immediate reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that. Talk about the role shame plays when people have issues that they may or may not be in control of.
Well, and that's part of why I feel so passionate about this, is kind of breaking the silence of some of these shameful experiences. But there's so much blame, or, you know, certainly in my experience when I had told other people, that's a common thread, you know, of reaching out and saying, I can't do this on my own, whether it was the eating disorder or wanting to tell somebody about the sexual abuse or the sexual assault or my drinking. It was always, it's not that bad, you know, and that kept me sick for a long time. I mean, I certainly don't look like an alcoholic, if somebody has an idea of what that looks like. And so rationalizing and comparing and wanting to keep that as a secret, because it was embarrassing. And it was also something that, especially as a woman, you know, wasn't talked about. And, you know, sex in general isn't talked about. If you're having good sex, people don't talk about it. So to look at it in a way that is hurtful and shameful, and it sometimes can be debilitating, is a different level.
In your practice, do you see more and more people being okay with their shameful and I don't mean shameful in a way, like their own internal shame.
Yeah.
A lot of times shame has nothing to do with the actual actions that you did. Someone hoisted themselves and made you find shame. Do you find that more and more people are coming forward and being open and okay? Or are we still at the point where people don't want to talk about their feelings or talk about the issues that are in their lives?
I've seen a change in the time that I've practiced over the last 12 years. And the growth that has happened just in our community in Chicago and then at large, you know, in the country, I think people are talking about it more, which normalizes it a little bit. You know, this is a story about survival. We're all surviving from something. And so much of my healing process has been hearing other people's stories. And so if I can offer that in hope of helping somebody else, then I've done my job. And I sought out hearing other people's stories. And, you know, I'm a cognitive behavioral therapist. So a lot of it is, okay, I recognize this as a problem. How do we change it now? Mm-hmm. And so rewiring the thinking and changing the behaviors. And on a simplistic level, it works if people listen, but we fight that so much. And so oftentimes people end up making it a lot more complicated than it really needs to be.
Yeah. Well, I mean, lastly, I at the end of the day, what's the takeaway from you putting your story and all the things you had to go through in your life on paper? What's the takeaway for you? I mean, is there something cathartic for the idea of putting this to paper and publishing myself?
Justin, I feel like I didn't have a choice. I mean, it was nothing I ever questioned, and it always felt right. And one thing, you know, led to another. And I thought the book was done until I got sober. And that was over 3.5 years ago. And so it was like, okay, this isn't finished yet. And it made it so much more rich. And so for me, it has so been a healing process, and very cathartic. But the takeaway also is to open up conversation for other people and to feel like I play an active role in that. And on a small level, I do that one-on-one, you know, with 8 mm-hmm. patients a day. But I want to expand the conversation. I have amazing conversations with clients in session. And to be able to, I just think everybody talks like that, but I know that's not the reality. So I'd like that to become more of the norm.
Well, I mean, it's a fascinating book. And I mean, we could talk for hours about where therapy is at and where it's going. Mm-hmm. But to be able to read your memoir, your autobiographical story about, you know, what essentially led you to this work, to social work, mm-hmm. Is very refreshing. Like I mean, I feel like whenever I've been in therapy, it takes about 5 minutes for me to go, what does this guy know? You know, so it's good to hear from therapists who have their own issues and how they overcome. The book is called Myself. It's published. It'll be starting this Christmas.
Correct.
And you can find it on Amazon, other places.
Yes.
Kelly Kitley, Serendipitous Psychotherapy. She's a licensed therapist who grew up here in Chicago. Kelly, thanks so much for coming in, and good luck with the book.
Thank you so much.
Pete, what do you think of Therapy Thursdays on the download. We just do 7 to 11. Kelly comes in. We take calls. I haven't asked her about it. I have a feeling she would say no, but could you imagine that?
I don't know. That's a good promotion for her business.
Yeah. And it would, I imagine.
Are you just trying to get out of therapy?
Exactly. Just do it here. No, I would like it to be where people call in and then they do their therapy public, right? They have to do that. They have to tell us what their problem is. And then they have the conversation. We just listen in. Me and you, we just listen in.
Yeah. It's anonymous.
Yeah. Except they have to give their name and where they're from.
Well, I don't know about that. But.
There's all these rules. Or we get to play 20 questions, like with the person, to try and guess who they are.
I have a feeling then you'll want to try to solve their problem as well.
Yeah. Well, it could be like the new Love Lines, you know? A love line.
Yeah, I mean, that one doctor and one
right. I'd play the Ricky Rackman. It was Ricky Rackman, yeah. The guy who was like the original Love Line guy. It was like him and Adam Carolla, and then they had Dr. Drew.
Oh, I just remember Dr.
Drew
and Adam.
You don't remember Ricky Rackman?
No,
he's like the Headbangers Ball guy.
I know the guy, yeah.
He was the original Love Lines host. And I believe Carolla and Dr. Drew were part of it, but Carolla was more of the kind of comic relief.
Right.
And Drew was, but Rackman was the guy who like lined it up, be like, let's go to Joe. He's got a problem with his penis. It's like one of the best shows ever in the history of radio, if you ask me. Like there's nothing better than people calling up with weird stuff. Like, oh, man. Can I ask how hot was the candle?
We could do it from 10 to 11.
We could, right? Well, you know, right away, my brain, and this is the problem with the brain, is you get into the 10 o'clock and, you know, we do a lot more theater of the mind, fun stuff, whether it be the frying pan or character flaws. Right away, I'm like,
people might not.
Let's get Kate James to play a therapist.
Yeah.
Right? That would be awesome. And that would be actually fun because you can call in with your problem and she can solve it. You know, or anyone. We just get like a character to play.
Yeah.
Actually, it's not a bad idea. And we can come up with like a new concept. Anyway.
Yeah.
We still have to work in, what was the memoir? Name of the memoir.
Yeah. Name the memoir. Name a celebrity.
Name a celebrity. And then we, for the next hour, take your calls and texts on what the memoir would be called. And if it's the right one, we give you pizza.
I think that idea and I think this therapist idea, I think they're both gold. We'll just kind of massage them a little bit.
It's a new season.
Yeah.
You know, we're kind of like the download's 10 o'clock hours like Adult Swim where, you know, you can expect it for like 6 or 7 weeks and then new stuff comes in. We try it out for 6 or 7 weeks and then go. You know, because we had Picnic and The Worst. I love The Worst. We'll keep doing that. You know, we had and Swap Meet. When is tomorrow?
Yeah, we're doing it tomorrow.
Oh, my gosh. You guys, it has been so long since we have done the Swap Meet with Greg Flamm. I mean, honestly, I can't before the election. And it has to do with we have scheduled Thursday nights with him. Like, that's the idea. When you're scheduling a show and he's a busy guy and I'm, you know, we want to make sure that we have a regular segment. So if you have stuff, you can call at the right time. And because of Blackhawks and Northwestern basketball and vacations and Thanksgiving, we have not had a swap meet in 6 weeks.
I hope Greg brings it's in crazy. Tomorrow. I hope we're doing it next week. Next Thursday too, right? Yeah, because we have a show next Thursday from 10 to 11. So we'll be 2 weeks in a row.
Yes. Good. I miss that. So that's one of my favorite segments we do on the show.
I wonder if he's going to bring in some like classic Chicago Christmas things.
Something
from like Marshall Fields or...
Well, let's do Christmas Swap Meet. That's great. We can do it this weekend.
Light up Santas.
It'll inevitably be someone going, I got a thing from Mayor Byrne. It's a flag from when the Pope was here. Hey, you know what? Okay, everyone's got something from when the Pope was here. That's what I love about it. All right, so coming up, we'll talk hip-hop artist, poet, and activist Malcolm London here on The Download 720. WGN, stay with us.
Everybody's losing their mind. This is how we party. When clubs, they try to charge me. I'm not spending money tonight. permission to live. It's a house party tonight.
Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is a poet, activist, and hip-hop artist. Malcolm London just released a new album, his debut album called Opia, and it's getting rave reviews. The Chicago-based musician enlists the help of some of his talented friends, Donnie Trumpet, Vic Mensa, Jamila Woods, just to name a few. They all show up on the new effort, which is not surprising because Malcolm has been a leader in the new poetry movement in Chicago for quite some time. If you're familiar with his name, it's because he has been in poetry, but he's also made headlines after being arrested during protests over the police shooting of Laquan McDonald. The charges were dropped after a considerable amount of pressure was put on the police disputing those events. London has been called the Gil Scott Heron of his generation by Dr. Cornel West, and he joins me in studio now. Malcolm London, welcome back to The Download. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me, man.
So my first question, I've known you for a couple of years. You've been a poet. You've been loud in a bomb. You've done a lot of work. Your activism work. We've seen you in the newspapers and such. Where's the music part come in? Is this a new venture for you?
It's not necessarily new. I've always been surrounded, I'm friends with Chance the Rapper, Vic Mensa, all these folks. And so I've always been surrounded by it. Maybe the want to do it is new, and it's particularly just because I see it as just another vehicle to have better conversations about things. You know, it's easier to play a hip hop record for a young person in the classroom than it is to like have them read one of my poems. And so, yeah, it's a new journey. But as a young person, I was a terrible rapper. So hopefully I proved those wrongs. When I was 12, my teacher was like, I read a rap. And she was like, that's a very good poem. And so hopefully that grown out of that.
But. Well, I mean, there's obviously tremendous similarities. Talk about the similarities and the differences between poetry and rap.
Yeah, I think, music, the musicality of it all is that even if I read a poem out loud or spit a cappella, there's a certain rhythm that I'm used to creating on my own. And now working with producers, shout out to my man Eric B. EB, he's one of the main mm-hmm. producers on the tape. One of those things is trying to fit to, a measure, a bar. And so I've grown so much respect for those artists, for being able to, for just artists in general. But because you want to make it catchy. You want to bring the music to the voice just as much as the pen.
Have you as an artist, as a lyricist, as a poet, have you learned more about the technical aspect of producing music?
Concepts, putting the beats together? Absolutely. Even down to like the notes and the keys and, all that stuff that I didn't think went, some folks make it look real easy. And it's not when you want to put a lot of effort into it, at least if you want to create something beautiful.
You mentioned some of the people, Chance the Rapper, Vic Mensa, and we've talked about these artists on our program, and we've talked to a lot of artists who've come out of the poetry scene here in Chicago. It's I feel like a broken record sometimes talking about how there has been this sort of renaissance, this explosion of talent. Yeah. Led by you and others who have, essentially from the Young Chicago Authors to what's happened at Harold Washington Library. I mean, this concept of so many young Chicagoans getting together to cooperate and collaborate in poetry.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of where it started. I mean, it was more than just like making art. It taught us how to build community. And, those things, those bonds and those interconnected, ideas are still with us today. Chanel will go off tour and be kicking it with Beyonce, and then like we'll go to Sky Zone with all his friends. You know what I mean? And so I think that camaraderie is still existing. It's not all over Chicago, but it is real, for us at least, and in part because of the people that help cultivate those spaces for us, folks like Kevin Colvin, Brother
Mike. Well, I was going to ask, but how do you get your start? Because you're one of the more well-known poets that have come out of the Chicago scene, but how did you get your start? Like a West Side Kid? Like what attracted you to this scene?
I think really just the community. I mean, I was definitely a kid who grew up on the West Side, and I always say I didn't know the West Side existed until I left the West Side. And what that means is that you don't really know how broke you are until you see people with money, And so I went to, like, Lincoln Park, and it wasn't until I stumbled upon Wordplay, which is a program we still have at Young Chicago Authors, and I, like, met a girl who had all blue hair and queer kid who like said it out loud, and this I fell in love with the space and fell in love with the idea to create myself or be able to do that without pressure or judgment. And so I think that's what I fell in love with first, and I think any young person that has that space to define for themselves mm-hmm. can create whatever they want, whether it's The Cure to Cancer or one of the greatest albums. Shout out to Chino for creating acid rap.
My guest, Malcolm London, poet, activist, hip-hop artist. Let's continue our conversation. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll get back with Malcolm here. His debut album is out. It's Opia. It's getting rave reviews. It's out now, and we'll continue our conversation here at the big table. Stay with us.
West side in the rain, no poncho for pain. Hardball played the way they bury saints. Dreaming in the alleyways, believing in the brighter day, just to see Kedzie without caution tape. West side in the rain, no poncho for pain. Hardball played the way they bury saints. Dreaming in the alleyways, believing in the brighter day, just to see Kedzie without caution tape.
Welcome back to The Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, Malcolm London, Chicago poet, activist, and now hip-hop artist. His debut album, Opia, is out. It's getting rave reviews. It's hearing it. I mean, Pete and I were talking about it, and we're like, I know Malcolm. I know the poetry, and I didn't know that it's obviously a natural extension to get into hip-hop. But let's talk about, we had Donnie in here, and there was one thing that was said that I thought was really interesting. I saw you sort of reference it as well in your stories, is about growing up in Chicago, having to go to a high school that's not in your neighborhood.
Right.
And what that does to a kid when you're talking about having to take a train or a bus to a different place, to a different part of town, and what that does for you in terms of opening your eyes.
Yeah. For me, yeah, my perspective was really back in high school. Donnie and No Name were two of my closest friends, and No Name lived on 87th Street, and Donnie lived in Rogers Park, and we were close-knit, right? And so bringing...
And you were living on the west side.
Yeah, west side, right, yeah. So, you know, those are obviously very far sides.
Far triangle of Chicago, right?
And so, like, that, you know, that is, I think, in essence, like, really, just even through that interaction, you have so many invisible borders that are broken down. But for me, at least, coming, you know, leaving the west side to Lincoln Park is where I went to high school, or to downtown, or to Rogers Park, you know, I just saw that it was different. And different, not necessarily in a bad way, not that I wanted any of my friends who lived in the Gold Coast to have any less. It just made me question, you know, why not I have any more, you know what I'm saying?
Well, just like you said right before the break, just the concept of, you know, being able to leave the west side, now you know there's a west side.
Right, yeah,
But there is something to that, and I mean, that's something that a lot of kids who might be in high school who live in some areas where they just go to the school that's just right down the block, or they take the bus right to the school, they don't get a chance to see the way the other half lives or anyone else lives.
Yeah.
That's a big part of how artists are born.
Yeah, I think so. Different perspectives definitely influence what I have to say, what I see.
How does that experience of being friends with people in different places, you know, going to a school that's miles away from where you grew up, how does that influence the music we hear in Opia? How does it influence the poetry that you come up with?
I think it just gives me a wider range of images to pull from. You know, poetry is a bunch of, is imagery, it's detail. And so having more than just, I mean, you could also tell a beautiful story and only live on the west side of Chicago and only be there. But I think it offers that. Yeah, I mean, that's really what I think the artists right now in Chicago are doing, is showing that there are different sides to Chicago. You know, even from the tourists that come here only come downtown, that there is, you know, there is a west side, and it doesn't look like what happens on, you know, 7 o'clock news or 9 o'clock news, and that, you know, those young people have dreams just like, you know, all young people do. And so I think, you know, that's what hip-hop is doing right now.
On the record, I mean, listening to it, the place is a big part of your work. There's a lot of references to the west side, but there's also references, I mean, it's not too many times you're going to hear a song reference Kedzie.
Right, yeah,
Like, I mean, but place is very strong to you. It means something to be from Chicago, to be from Austin, to be able to rap and spit about the things that you know.
Yeah.
How important is that for you as a musician, as an artist, to reference place?
Yeah. One of my favorite poets, her name's Gwendolyn Brooks. She said, our duty as poets and writers is only to tell the story right in front of our nose. And so, you know, that's important, you know, to tell where I come from, to tell people that there's more here. And then hopefully not only to tell the story, but to change the story, you know. And so hopefully by doing that, by offering validation to that story, hopefully folks will begin to see that, you know, it's complicated. It's not just one thing, it's many things. But that means, you know, there's things to be changed and things to be.
Do you feel like there's an accurate story being told about the West Side or the South Side of Chicago?
No,
I mean,
not.
You mentioned it with the 7 o'clock, 9 o'clock news. I mean, are we, as a Chicago as a whole, are we getting the an accurate story portrayal of what the West Side is like?
Nah, but that's why you got to go chase different perspectives when they exist. I don't know too many people. I mean, shout out to Saba, but I don't know too many people who are repping the West Side right now. So hopefully when those stories come out that people listen
and that,
to.
And that, I mean, that is something. I mean, we've had conversations a lot of Cook County Commissioner Richard Boykin's on, you know, and we'll talk about the West Side. But you're right. It almost always is about some of the more negative storylines.
Yeah.
You know, they're trying
right.
to fix something, whether it be gun violence or poverty, things of that nature. I mean, is that difficult for you being from the West Side to know that whenever you hear the West Side, it's only in that context?
Sometimes, but I think I just know the truth, you know, and so part of that is like just trying to prove the haters wrong, really.
Malcolm London's my guest in studio tonight. He's got a new album. It's Opia. It's getting rave reviews. You can find it on iTunes, Tidal, all the places that you can find new music. All right, let's take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. Let's talk about activism and its role in your music, because that's the other side of you. You know, you've been sort of a voice for the movement, the political movement, the activist movement here in Chicago for a number of years now. And like I said in the lead at the beginning of the hour, ran into trouble a little bit when you were arrested at a protest after December of last year. We'll talk with Malcolm London some more here on The Download. Stay with us.
You open it up and it's a laced gummy bear.
Did you see that story?
They got laced gummy bear, like the kids got sick from
it.
We were off yesterday. Was it a pot gummy bear?
I don't know.
Is that
I'm
the
not
idea?
Sure.
Like I was confused by the headline.
Mushroom,
I only
like
saw
a mushroom
like,
type
well,
thing.
Well, I think it was a marijuana in one of the schools locally. But the question was that like 17 kids got sick from it.
I think it was Naperville North.
And was it marijuana? Was that the idea that
That's
it was...
what they think. The investigation is ongoing. But here's the thing. And
thank
I'm
you.
I'm
thank
a cynic.
You. Here it is. Here's
okay,
the thing with Rob Martier.
Oh, we didn't know
exactly,
the gummy bears
exactly.
were laced. We had no idea.
They're the victims. We were just taking random gummy bears out of people's pockets on the gum, like the end of Ferris Bueller.
Meanwhile, they're taking them from Spicoli.
Yeah,
you know,
that's I thought the same exact thing, Rob. I was like, there is no way that these kids took a.
We all want to think
bear.
Our kids are angels and they can do no wrong. I'm not buying it.
But the question I had was, was it just a poorly made marijuana gummy bear?
Well,
like, was
I mean,
it a poor, like, did it make them sick? Like, did they throw up or something because it wasn't what they thought it was? Or did they inadvertently get too high from it? Like, that's the part I was confused by.
You know, dude, if only an ounce is good, three has got to be better, don't you think? Totally.
So there you go. We've gotten to the bottom of the gummy bear stuff.
And new rules are coming to United Airlines when it comes to using overhead bins. Let me warn you, you won't be happy.
When United Airlines rolls out its new no-frills basic economy class seats next year, it will offer the lowest available price, but basic economy riders will not be permitted to use the overhead bins. Carry-ons will only be allowed under the seats. Flyers have been expressing outrage online. Even Senator Chuck Schumer of New York releasing a statement saying air travelers are sick and tired of being nickel and dimed. United says overhead bins are still available for passengers riding regular economy and above. Ryan Burrow, WGN News.
You know what, though? Here's my problem with that. And I hate that story, as everybody does who listens. But the question I have is, are you going to see a significant reduction in that ticket's cost? You know what I mean? Are you going to see, like, those tickets that you don't have to carry on bag are now $200?
Right.
Or is that going to be the regular $300 and everything else is now $400? That's where I'm like, Schumer, get your head out of your butt and don't let him do that. That's the part that gets me as a consumer, where I'm like, you guys are essentially taking the basic principle of consumer protection is this idea that they offer you something and then they change the offer because, you know, the idea that they change it to make it more profitable for them.
Well,
that's ridiculous. You can't do that.
You're right. And U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer out of New York has been at the forefront of this battle. I'm with you on that, but I tend to go in the opposite direction. If you're going to charge me, stop nickel and diming me to death and just roll it into the price of the ticket.
Right.
So, for instance, if the ticket's $350 and all of these other charges are going to cost me, just charge me the $400.
Yeah, don't say it's $250 and then, oh, but it's $25, and if you're going to breathe on this flight, it's $15.
Exactly.
Yeah, I got you.
If you can't help us, if you can't flap your arms and help us fly this bird, then that's going to be an extra $200.
But, I mean, I would love to see if United Airlines says, okay, we're not offering any frills, anything. If you can walk on with the shirt on your back, we'll give you this flight for $175. I'll take it. I'll get that. I'll be like, okay. But if they're going to be like, nah, what you used to be able to carry a bag on, but now you don't, and it's the same price. It's like, all right.
Well, it's Spirit.
Yeah, right.
But Frontier.
And Spirit, the problem I have with Spirit, well, a lot of problems with Spirit, but the issue is it's not that much cheaper. At the end of the day, for you to take Spirit Airlines is only $30 cheaper than the next, you know, sort of discount carrier. So it's like, again, I love the Spirit concept. Just make it cheaper and tell me, you know what? You can't bring anything, nothing in your pockets.
I'm walking.
You can wear all you can wear is your undershirt and your undershirt and boxer shorts, and that's it.
Right.
What if it's cold out?
And that's your problem. $110. There you go. I fixed it.
Opia. The ambiguous intensity of looking someone in the eye, which can feel both invasive and vulnerable.
You're a mess, young boy.
Oranges and apples, one nation under God, foreclosed in a chapel. Everybody sitting while they pointing fingers high, horse get straddled, but even I, a snake, and my baby need a rattle. Here we go! One day he gon' detox like Dr. Dre dropping detox. They say one day he gon' detox, he ain't gon' detox. Nah, they only see depression when they see his scars. Thinking you a big fish, they don't see you dreaming in a pond. Here we go!
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest at the big table tonight, Malcolm London, longtime poet here in Chicago, as well as an activist and a hip-hop artist as well. His debut album is out. It's called Opia, and it's on iTunes, Tidal, all the places you can get music. It's getting great reviews. It's a great record. I mean, and I really do like it because your poetry has always been something that I've been attracted to, just in the way that you tell the story of your life, and it's interesting. But it's also the production that you mix with this record is pretty great. Excellent. And let's talk about the activism, because that is a part of the record as well. I mean, you're not just talking about what you had for breakfast. There's a lot that goes into it. I mean, there's some really frank and concise things about Chicago, you know, growing up here, and actual current political climate that you use on the album.
Yeah, I mean, activism influences the album and the tape, but just more so in the thought process of it. I think activism influenced the tape in ways that, like, I was trying to avoid, you know what I mean, if that makes sense. So I knew people would expect from me, like, an album that would talk about the issues.
But you don't want to preach.
Right, exactly. Because even, like, as a music consumer, I don't like to just be like, I don't listen to Public Enemy all the time, right? Like, I like music that talks about the human experience that I can connect to, that's relatable. And so I think that's one of the things I was trying to prove with the album, or let people know that, you know, one, even as a multi-hyphen person, you know, I'm still a person. And even though I wear different hats in different spaces, you know, I'm still just a kid trying to figure out how to hold all of that. And so I wanted to tell that story, which in turn the name Opia, which stands for the ambiguous intensity of looking someone in the eye, which can feel both invasive and vulnerable. And so I wanted to just have a vulnerable, honest album, even if, like, I still am figuring out how to rhyme couplets and, like, get my Nas on and, you know what I mean, really flow. I wanted folks to just get a real honest album that is both about me and fighting for what I believe in, you know, who the women that I love and, you know, my mom, my girl, you know, whoever, and just like making a good
record. Do you feel as an artist, do you have a responsibility to tell people in your work and your art about the movement that you've been a leader on, whether it be with BYP 100 or the Laquan McDonald protests we saw? Do you feel like there's a responsibility or people are counting on you to tell that story or to send that message?
For me, I feel that responsibility. I think that's really obvious. But, you know, I think that I'm accountable to communities of people that expect certain things of me. I've talked to this about my friends, and I do they ever feel that responsibility? And I think, you know, it's also a beautiful thing for artists just to make art and feel like that art is what it is, and that, you know, because I also don't like when a newscaster is like, oh, there's this joke that I think Dave Chappelle has. Anyway, where he's like, you know, this 9/11, he's like, let me see what Ja Rule thinks on this. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes it's not on artists to, like, you know, because even now, like, I think, like, some, you know, even folks to talk about the movement, you know, you shouldn't go to Kanye for, like, what's happening in Black Lives Matter. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I...
His opinion matters.
Yeah, of course. And they're right. I mean, you get to a certain point where you'd say for Kanye West or even in Ja Rule that they're a little bit out of the loop. They're
not.
But you're different.
Yeah,
you're different
in the
way that you're a leader of a movement. Yeah, I mean, you were in the newspapers for what happened. And so, I mean, do you find yourself a little bit more conflicted in the way that, yes, you're not like Kanye West in the way that you're living up in your Brentwood estate Kim Kardashian, you know, like you're...
I mean, although I'd like a Brentwood estate with Kim Kardashian.
You'll be there someday.
Just,
you're getting there. But right now, you understand the movement, and you're part of this Chicago political movement that is garnering a lot of attention. So it's a little bit different in your case because you are the eyes on the street.
Yeah, and in that way, I do feel a responsibility to talk about the things. Also, for those 3 years I was organized, I'm also proud of this tape. So, for real, if you're listening, you know, go listen to it. Because it's also the first thing I've created in a long time, or at least a complete body of work. I've been working on my book, which is also set to be released next year, Book of Poetry. But it took so long because of the organizing.
I was going to ask you about that, yeah.
And because of, you know, going to the UN and, like, feeling like every moment is the revolutionary moment, right? Or, like, this is the moment that the change, you know, is going to happen. And so what that did is just like it put me in a weird place with my imagination, because normally if I imagine something, I want to see the world look differently, I'm writing it down, you know, and like having words to connect with my heart. But as an organizer, it's like, all right, I want to, you know, change this thing, and so I go do it, which is a beautiful thing too. Mm-hmm. But it didn't make my art suffer. It just gave me a different creative outlet.
Let's put the organizer to the side. Yeah. Now that you're firmly entrenched in art, you're working on the music and the poetry as well. You have a little bit of time to look at that experience.
Right,
you
reflect
know,
on it.
When reflecting on that experience, do you think that the Chicago's better off because of the movement? Because of a move? I mean, are we seeing change that we wouldn't have seen 2-3 years ago?
Yeah, I like to think so, because then I'm not like, oh, man, I gave 3 years of my life and didn't get paid for it to, like, organize it. But, I mean, yeah, I mean, absolutely, especially in the city of Chicago. You know, we won reparations in the city, which has never been done in America, reparations to the John Birch survivors. That happened because of, you know, years of organizing. They got the Dyer High School for the teachers who went on that hunger strike. They didn't get what they wanted or how they wanted it, but they did. You know, I mean, the UN called out the Chicago Police Department for its corruption. You know, things are happening. People who are not involved in the movement are out here talking about police accountability. They're out here talking about what happens when the court system lets us down. You know, these are ideas that are pushing, and you can't contribute that to me or one person in the moment, but I think that's the beautiful part, is it does feel like things are changing. So I don't feel like it's a waste, but even as an artist now, I have to be conscious of making sure I shout out people who are doing the work, who don't get to be on WGN, who don't get to be, you know, on late night TV, making sure that, you know, because they're also doing 50 hours a week for just for doing something they believe in.
Do you see yourself as, you know, as you're doing your art now, do you ever see yourself going back that way, being a leader of an activist in the way that being more entrenched in the movement like you were years back?
Absolutely. I don't think I'm ever outside of the movement. I just, my role is different right now in this moment. And I think, you know, at least in my head, you know, almost being arrested and almost dying, you know, made me realize where I need to, like, put something out in the world.
Really?
And so, yeah.
When you say almost dying, just from...
Well, when I was choked, when I was arrested, I was choked and passed out and, like, saw the light, quote unquote, you know, but eventually came to. I wasn't scared that night, though. It just kind of felt, I saw myself, like, saying, like, oh, this is it. This is what happens when you fight for what you believe in. This is, like, what governments do sometimes. But then I came to, but it felt like I was going to lose my life. But after that, it made me, you know, realize y'all.
I was gonna say, what impact did that have on you? Not just the near death experience, but going through all of that, going into jail, you know, the charges that were against you, getting out off those charges, like that whole experience. Looking back on that, I mean, what's your takeaway from that?
Yeah, basically, really, to fight even harder, really. But you know, just also getting more creative with how that fight looks, and especially in terms of music. And so, like, you know, I'm here because of James Baldwin. You know, I'm here because of Tupac. You know, Changes and Keep Your Head Up, right? I'm also here because folks that I do not know the names of organized, you know, whether it be 50 years ago or 20 years ago, organized for a better school, organized for the right to vote, right? I'm also here because of them, but what inspires me was the music and the culture. And so, you know, just getting back to being a cultural worker as well as an organizer and a worker for the people.
Well, it starts with the new album called Opia. It's out right now. You can get on Apple Music, Tidal, hip-hop Spotify. Artist, Spotify, of course. Hip-hop artist, poet, activist, Malcolm London in studio tonight. Malcolm, great to see you, and thanks for coming.
Yeah,
we appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks for having me.
Really riled people up quick with the when we start talking about airports and the airlines. It's like they were waiting. I got 5 or 6 texts in a row about that story, and Twitter too. How about that? Yeah, I my biggest pet peeve with airlines, and I know that there's ways to manipulate this if you really pay attention to it, but it's the fact that a domestic flight to nowhere, you know, going west, is more than $300. I just feel at a certain point, while we were all just sort of like a lobster in a pot of water, we watched ticket prices and airlines go from 200, 250 to 350, 400. You know, right now, I remember a time, and not too long ago, I'm talking about maybe in the last decade, where if you were within a week, right, and you had to find a flight, they'd want $450 for it. And you're like, oh my gosh, that's crazy.
Yeah.
That's crazy, right? That's crazy. And now, you look out 5 months from now, and you're like, I might want to go to, you know, Las Vegas or California, mm-hmm. $450. And that's the cheap. That's Spirit.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
It's also, do you ever meet these people? They're around where they're always getting good airfare.
Yeah.
How's that happen? Like, I look.
I have to say, I was walking from the bus. I take the bus to Madison in Michigan, right? And I walk up Michigan Avenue. And there is a travel store
mm-hmm.
that you can go in. I never saw this before. It's probably been there for years, and I'm just oblivious, listening to my music, listening to my Malcolm London record. But there's an actual, like, old school, almost travel agency,
yeah.
but it's set up differently. It's like desks and computers. So you walk in, and it's all about airfare. So I stopped and kind of looked in, but it was essentially you walk in going, I got to get to L.A.
And they do the cheapest fare for you, but...
Yeah.
But, you know, we all have computers that we could look it up.
So
but
they
you know,
must
like,
have tricks, man.
Yeah, there's, you know, there's websites and there's alerts and, like, you know, Southwest will come out with, I get this email, like, you know, oh, 48-hour sale. I'm like, oh, you know,
I'll take
a quick trip to Nashville or something. You'll get a 50, because it says, like, $59.
Right.
$59. No, it's, you know, by the time you get
the
times.
It's $320.
Yeah, exactly. It's so annoying.
I do the alerts.
Oh really?
I got one to Boston, $70.
Both
round,
ways?
Round trip, yeah.
What?
Yeah, like I don't.
I'll give you. I will give you $35 commission if you can pull that for me, from here on out, Esmeralda. Like, you're my travel agent.
You just gotta do the alert.
You set them up
for all the cities you want, and then they just show up, and you kind of have to think like, because there's a lot where it's like this weekend, and you're like, no, I can't do that. But sometimes it'll be a couple
I'll
months.
Mess that
and,
up. I'll mess it up. You're in charge of my travel itinerary from here on out. And
like
I'm looking.
I'm looking right now for Cancun.
When you got the trip to Boston, was it a couple of days That
no,
you,
no, it was a
trip
month
they
or
were
two.
Planning.
$70
Yeah, I was planning it in the way of my boyfriend's brother lives there, and we were like, yeah, we should go sometime. We both enjoy that city. And then I got an email about it. I was like, well, now's the time. Let's.
That's because they're
figure
listening
out a time.
To you. That's because their phone. The phone is a microphone, and it's listening to you. And they're like, all right, Esmeralda's on the fence about Boston. Let's,
yeah, well, if that's how it is, then
you
yeah,
know that's how
I need
feel
to
like
go to Cancun under 200. Can I do that? Let's hope that email yeah. shows up.
What are these websites? Because I like yeah I've heard you know I try a bunch of these websites and I get these yeah. alerts like from Airfare Watchdog and whatnot.
Yeah, I do the Airfare Watchdog, Booking Buddy,
and yeah, it just it never works. Like
I don't know
yeah,
any of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean that's.
You
it's
click
few and
on
far
it,
between.
And then it takes you to a bunch of different, you know, 10 windows pop up, and
no,
I can't
well,
figure out.
What I get the one. I do specific. I do specific places, so I okay. have to like. I'll see something on TV, like I watch a lot of No Reservations with Anthony Bourdain.
Oh,
I'm like, I want to go yeah. there, so then yeah. I just set up like to Spain, to the Azores, to Singapore, and then you know.
If something pops up?
When they pop up and I'm like, wow, well, it's a really good price and it's maybe I can figure it out.
Whenever Anthony Bourdain does Chicago, I always think of somebody from those places you just mentioned going, I want to go to Chicago.
Yeah.
And like showing up at the Billy
Goat. In Singapore.
Or,
yeah.
or hanging out with Bruce at the Old Town Ale House. I'm like, that's what you came to Chicago to do?
That's what I would do. That's like, yeah.
I did that when we went to San Francisco. I felt like Anthony Bourdain was sort of my travel guide. Like we went to like all the restaurants that he talked about.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, except the tiki bar in the old Fairmont on the top of the hill at Knob Hill. There's a tiki bar in the bottom of the Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco that's legendary. And he went.
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah,
I want to go there.
And I wanted to go. We missed. That was the one. It's just like you get to San Francisco and you're kind of at the bottom of the hill. And you're like, that's all right. That's a big hill. Let's just go to the hotel bar.
See, like right now, I have a thing for Miami. 107, what? Chicago to Miami round trip.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
That sounds like it's like, wow, to go to Miami?
So
yeah.
Wait,
I'd take that in a heartbeat. I'd take that right now.
I hate to do this on air, but...
You want to just give me your account and password. We'll figure it out.
So you go to the, you know, so you go to, because I have the Airfare Watchdog and I just have the general. So you just pick cities and they'll email you city.
Yeah, you
city
go to my alerts.
Okay.
And then you can set up alerts.
I'm like, I'm doing this.
And then they just email you. And they kind of, I like the Airfare Watchdog because they tell you a little bit more like where they found it. If it was on the website or if it was on like one of those where it's like the million windows that pop up. And they tell you, well, we looked around this date and we were able to find it. Or you might have to be flexible. Or you might have to do this. So you kind of have to do a little tinkering. But
I see.
Still.
Now the tinkering comes in.
Yeah, right.
Now we find
that
out that Esmeralda's spending about 45 hours a week on this.
Well, that's the thing, too, because Stephanie Menendez here, she's going to Iceland for like $50. Something
oh, that's
like
because
ridiculous.
Man, if she's loser. Going on that, because Iceland just started an airline that comes here and they were doing insanely cheap flights.
Yeah.
For promo.
Every time I'm like you, Pete, though. Every time I hear this, I'm like 2 days late and they're like, no, it's now $7.50.
Yes, I
and
never.
I'm like, what happened? I never can do it. Well, a new segment, new 10 o'clock segment. Esmeralda tells us what's the cheapest air flyer. We just do that on Friday nights.
Yeah.
Yeah. You call in with what city you want to go to, and Esmeralda then explains to you.
I start figuring it out. Well, you have to do yeah. a layover that's 3 hours long, and then this.
Or even worse, you like go to, can I get your name and password? Let me just set this up for you. All you do
your
is set up
card?
Alerts and through their credit card. That's good stuff.
Let's go, 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 White Sox. Chicago's proud of you.
Yes, that's what we like to hear. Finally, some news about the other Chicago baseball team. It's not winning World Series and capturing America's heart. The Chicago White Sox made some big moves today to actually trade Adam Eaton, and yesterday trade Chris Sale, their all-star world beater, if you will, starting pitcher. And what they get in return? They got a ton of prospects, some of the best prospects in baseball. Will they pan out? We're not sure. Are the White Sox done? We're not sure. Will they be better? We're not sure. Sam Panionovich may have some of the answers. WGN Radio Sports. Sam, how's it going, buddy?
Hey, what happened? I just woke up from a two-day slumber. Did I miss anything?
You didn't miss nothing. Let me ask first about Chris Sale. I mean, there was so much made in the last month just about general managers getting together and will the White Sox sell, and it started to heat up and heat up. There were a lot of suitors, it seemed, but why did the White Sox land on trading Chris Sale to the Red Sox?
Well, because they got the top prospect in Major League Baseball. I mean, they got Yoan Moncada from the Boston Red Sox, who many feel is going to be a surefire MVP candidate for the next 10 years or so. And the package that they got, I mean, they got the top player, the top prospect in baseball, rather, and they got Michael Kopech, who throws 100 miles an hour. He was their top pitching prospect. They got four players for Chris Sale, and you and I talked about this in August after he had cut up all those jerseys and went haywire. That was like the second incident he had of the season. And I told you point blank, I said, he's gone at the end of the season because they were tired of his antics. No matter how good you are, how strong you throw, what you do on the mound, if you're not on board with the organization, that's a red flag. And Rick Hahn had finally had enough. They had dealt with a lot of the crybaby stuff he had put up with, and it was time to move on. I think both sides agreed with that. I think Washington, didn't have enough. They didn't want to unload a couple of their other guys. So Boston was desperate. They wanted a frontline starter, and it was a match made in heaven. Boston's happy. Chicago's happy. And unfortunately, a lot of Sox fans are going to be upset because this is probably the most dominant starter they've had in the last 50 years.
Yeah.
But look at what you got back.
Yeah, I mean, you got great stuff.
There's a plan
back
here. There's a plan, Justin. There's a plan. And they haven't had a plan on the South Side for 10 years.
You know, I think that a lot of White Sox fans, even they were happy with the, obviously having a dominant pitcher on the South Side, but it was pretty evident from a fan standpoint that he didn't want to be there. That, you know, the antics of cutting up jerseys or speaking out against management before the season even began over a 14-year-old kid. You know, this wasn't the first time he had spoken out against management. He sort of had a love-hate relationship with this White Sox organization. And speaking as a fan, you kind of got sick of it.
You did, but that's not to take away from the competitor that Chris Sale was. Look, he wanted to win. He made that very clear, and he signed a very team-friendly contract in 2013 to keep him here for a long time. That was never the concern. It was just the frustration that started to bubble over. And you know full well that Chris Sale wanted to win more than anybody in that clubhouse. And when you look at the last couple of seasons, 78 wins, 76 wins, 73 wins, 63 wins. And then the best season he was a part of was in 2012. They won 85 games, and they collapsed on the stretch.
Yeah.
He never pitched in the playoffs. He's never pitched in the postseason in his career, and that's something that he just craved. And I think he knew that that was not going to happen here. So I'm not going to say he forced his way out, but he certainly didn't help his own case.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about what – I mean, obviously the number one prospect in baseball, Yoan Moncada. Is he baseball ready? Is he pro-level ready? I mean, we're going to see the infielder on opening day?
No, I would doubt that he starts on opening day because I don't think they want to place that sort of pressure on him. You know, he's only 21 years old. The Red Sox brought him up last August. It wasn't all that great, but this happens. I mean, the Padres called up Anthony Rizzo in his first season, and he was awful, and they sent him down and eventually traded him to the Cubs. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. I think this is a guy that is going to come up and play second base maybe around June or July because it's easier to ease a player in that way. When you put the pressure of number one prospect in baseball, the last thing you want to do is throw him out there opening day. Remember, he's Cuban too. So to play here in 40-degree weather in April, not exactly advantageous. You keep him in Arizona or you bring him to North Carolina, wherever you have to play him. You play him in a warm weather place, and then when the sun starts coming out, we get 70, 80-degree weather, you bring him up, and the team is not going to be good. I mean, we all know that. The team is going to be pretty much like a 60 or 70-win team, so there's not going to be much expectations, no pressure. They will ease him in, but I would be shocked if they don't bring him up by the trade deadline.
Okay, about Kopech, too, the hard-throwing pitcher who at one point was up to 105 miles per hour. Is he close to pro-ready, or is this another guy we're going to see in single, double A until later in the season, if not at all this season?
Oh, I love how you're doing this. You're like, I want them now. I need them now. I need them in 2017. No, Kopech's even younger. In fact, you know, last season he spent most of his time in high A ball in Salem with the Red Sox. He was 4-1. He had a 2.25 ERA, 82 strikeouts, not a lot of walks. But this is a guy that was drafted out of high school. So he's a big Texan. He throws hard. You mentioned 105. He averages around 98. He's not going to come out and throw 105 every pitch,
right,
because his arm would fall off.
He's a starter.
But he's a starting pitcher. And when you look at the rotation, you look at Carlos Rodon, you look at Kopech, you look at a guy like Alec Hansen, who they just brought in last season. You look at Giolito, who they got from the Nationals for Adam Eaton.
That's next.
You have a lot of serious arms in this organization now. Now, whether they're pro ready or not next year, the plan is for this team to win in 2018 or 19. This is a rebuild here. This is an absolute rebuild, and they are not going to contend next year. You have to remember that going forward. This is not a patch. This is not a Band-Aid.
I don't have a problem with that. I want to see this team gel as quick as possible, but I actually love the philosophy here, Rick Hahn and the White Sox, because, you know, the AL Central has had a representative for the American League in the World Series the last 3 years. The Indians, Tigers, and Royals still have, you know, are on top of their game. Maybe the Royals are on their way down, but all three of them look to compete. The idea that in 2 or 3 years, those teams will be facing the idea of having to rebuild themselves while the White Sox are on the upswing, it actually makes a lot of sense.
And I'll tell you what, I thought about this earlier today when they actually sent Eaton to Washington and got those players back. I thought to myself, if the Cubs don't win the World Series, does this happen? And it's an interesting thing to think about, because when the Cubs bottomed out, you know, they won 100, or they lost 100 games in 2012. I think they lost 101. And they preached patience. And they preached that we will build this up over time. That worked out. And now for Rick Hahn, who is undoubtedly pulling all the control on the south side. These are not Kenny Williams moves. You know, Kenny Williams would have traded for a 30-year-old left-handed hitter. Or he would have signed Bartolo Colon, who's 43 years old. He would have tried to do
that's
the short
how thing. They've done it in the last 10 years, right.
This is something that's going to buy him time, because when you point to the north side of Chicago and you say, look, it worked for them. They are World Series champs because they bottomed out, they drafted the right players, they made shrewd trades, and they're the best team in baseball right now. So this is going to buy Rick Hahn a lot of time, and that's exactly what this is. This is something that's going to take time. But it's so refreshing to have direction in sports. The worst thing in professional sports is not to have a plan. You know, it's you would rather be the worst team in the league than be the 20th best team in the league, because you get better over time, because you get higher picks, and then you're able to build young players and build up your organization. And that's something they haven't had for a long,
long
time.
Let me ask you about the trade today. Adam Eaton, who's a center fielder, started for the White Sox, had a serviceable year on a losing squad, but he goes to Washington. Surprising to me that the White Sox were able to pull a guy like Lucas Giolito, was really yesterday before the Chris Sale trade was at the centerpiece of a Chris Sale trade. I mean, and he was considered to be one of the after Moncada went, he was next, right? I feel like the White Sox got some serious value from a pitcher who got some looks last year, so he's not that far off from contributing to this roster.
Yeah, in the span of about 35 hours, they got the number one position prospect and the number one pitching prospect. If that isn't a Grand Slam home run, nothing is. Now, Giolito's interesting because he's a guy who could probably come in early next year. I wonder when they're actually going to start him. But that was their top prospect. So you have the top prospect from Boston, the top prospect from Washington, and right now in baseball, the White Sox have the following number prospects: 1, 3, 30, and 38, and none of those guys were a part of this on Sunday.
Wow. And none of you don't think we'll see Giolito this year?
I think Giolito, he started a lot for Washington last year, so I think you could probably bring him up as well, but I am so far-fetched. I am not thinking about 2017.
I'm picturing
them losing so many games.
No.
That'll build character.
I think they're going to one up the Cubs, and they'll all start at the age of 20, 21, and it'll be the youngest team ever to win a World Series.
Well, you had the Bulls going 82-0, I don't know.
All right, let me ask you this. In lieu of losing Adam Eaton, who plays the outfield for the White Sox? I was trying to think.
Who cares? They've got Avi Garcia on a one-year tender. I think it's a one-year contract.
He plays right.
He might play right field. You've got the Nutria product, local kid. I think he's from Winnetka, Charlie Tilson, who they traded for last year.
Yeah, he blew out his hammy, like on the first game he came up.
He'll be in full strength this season. So, it's going to take time, and they're going to maybe sign some guys to one-year contracts just to sort of bridge the gap. And they might even make some more trades. I mean, let's not forget, you still have Jose Quintana, who you can trade and get four other players. You've got David Robertson, who's a closer. Everybody needs a closer. You could trade him closer to opening day. You could trade him at the deadline. And then you've got Todd Frazier, who hit 40 home runs last year at third base. I would be shocked if he played all next season with Chicago. So you look at all the players they got, and then you look at the players that they still have on this roster that other teams do want, maybe even Jose Abreu. Everybody's got to go. You've already committed to this. You don't trade Sale and then trade Eaton and then go, oh, okay, we're all right. No, you do this with 2 feet in, and they're going to keep dealing. They're going to deal through the offseason, and they're going to deal through next season. Remember, they're not going to win next year, so they're going to have even more guys that are going to be up for grabs.
That's an interesting thought. So you could see players like Frazier, even Melky Cabrera or Jose Quintana start with the Sox on opening day, but find themselves in different uniforms by the trading deadline because of their play that year.
Right, and then when you get to the trade deadline, because of the extra wild card team now, you need a starting pitcher. Hey, you need a third baseman. You need a closer. This is your one piece to win you a championship. And then, boom, you get a guy who's desperate. You get a GM who is, you know, trying to make the postseason. They're going to unload young players. That's the way it goes.
Look at what the Yankees got from the Cubs for Aldis Chapman, right?
They got four guys. Yeah. And then they just signed Chapman like 20 minutes ago. Yeah, he's going back to New York.
So that was a great deal for them. Well, I'm excited. I hope that it's sooner than later, but I understand that we have to wait a year. But it's exciting that the White Sox are restocking and went from, like you said, having nobody in the prospect list to four guys in the top 40. That's a major plus. Will we see the kid from Vanderbilt this year? He came up in the middle relief a little bit, Fulmer. He came in. Does he slot into the starting rotation?
You know, they might keep him in the bullpen, actually, and that's what Don Cooper talked about last year, the pitching coach. He could start. He could throw out of the bullpen. He could do a number of things, but I think for sure he's up next year. You've got a couple other arms in the minors, and then you've got some guys like Zach Birdie, their first-round pick last year out of Louisville, throws 101. You've got Zach Collins, a catcher from Miami.
Yeah.
I love the way they've been drafted in the last couple of years. I have one question for you. Maybe you can answer this. Did they lock Kenny Williams in a closet all week?
He's trying so hard. Yeah, maybe you know he's gelling with his new role of just what is he, president or something, playing golf? Yeah, he'll be in charge of the 1 year tenders, right? They're like, Kenny, you can pick any journeyman you want. You can pick him, and that's what he gets. So that's
Well, I'll send him a Christmas card because I'm happy he stayed out of the way.
Sam Fenianovich, WGN Radio Sports, talking about the White Sox big haul in the last couple days of the winter meetings, and there could be more. Sam, thanks for joining us, man.
Take care.
Coming up tomorrow night, wow, look at this, consecutive downloads. You don't usually get that at this time of year. Tomorrow night, I'm very excited about this, and I am at page 200 of a 300-page book of the 18 in Life on Skid Row memoir of lead singer Sebastian Bach. A lot of hard partying, a lot of fighting, a lot of youth gone wild. I'm at the point right now where Sebastian Bach came off stage maybe in, I forgot where it was, like Kentucky, after an altercation where he said something bad about the headliners, John Bon Jovi's band, Bon Jovi.
Mm-hmm.
And as he was walking off the stage, what he said was like 300 people were walking towards him, led by John Bon Jovi, who was like, "You say that stuff about me on stage?" Took a swing at him, missed. A lot of fighting, pushing, things like that.
Wow.
That's where I'm at in the book.
This is some good stuff. Some juicy bits.
It's a lot of, man, we did a lot of drugs back then. That should be the name of it. We did a lot of drugs back then. Sebastian Bach will be our guest tomorrow. Tomorrow also, former members of the Neo Futurists, Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind, the show that is... it's ending at the Neo Futurists up on Foster and Ashland and Andersonville next, I guess, New Year's Eve. It's the last show. Greg Allen, the founding member, has decided to embark on taking the show elsewhere, not being part of the Neo Futurists lineup anymore. A lot to talk about. We will have some of the original members, Phil Ritterelli, Dave All, Rachel Claff will be in studio tomorrow. We'll talk about the... legacy and the memories of Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind, a show that we've all everybody in Chicago has some memory associated to. And also the guys from Mystery Science Theater 3000. How great is that? That's a great show. That's tomorrow night.